Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. We do have a quorum. It is Tuesday, March 29th, 2011. And on today's agenda, we have the E-12 Education Omnibus Bill. And the author is ready to present. It's Senator Jen Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if I'm ready or not, but it's going to come anyway. Education actually has been, our E-12 has been treated very well in this challenging times for all of our budget efforts to bring a balanced budget and yet to retain some of our priorities. And we are actually showing a growth in revenue in E-12 education. Over the past biennium, the budget was $13.3 billion, and in the Senate 11, 12, and 12, 13 school years, fiscal year 12 and 13, it would be $14.2 billion. And that represents, if you're not counting federal stimulus, $973.5 million more than fiscal 10-11. And counting that, it's $473.5 million more. So we don't have less money. There's money that's a part of the growth is committed to E-12 education. And our levies, the forecast for the 11-12 and 12-13, with $2.175 billion and $2.285 billion, our Senate proposal is $2.269 billion. So it's not huge, but it's between 16 and 17 million less than the forecast. So, and one of the things that we are doing, and you will get into greater detail as we go through, we are, for the first time in several years, adding some to the formula, $50 in each of the 2 years. So the average for 12-13 school year revenue per student, which doesn't include food and community ed and debt service and federal funds, is going to be the projected was $9,440. It will be $9,559 in our basic revenue. So with that, just brief overview, we did in fact make some cuts, and we are also bearing, in terms of the helping to resolve the budget challenge of $5 billion, are carrying a pretty big hunk of that by retaining the shift and allowing it to go back based on the way the law lays out, that as the revenue comes in what order that is addressed. And that amounts to about $1.4 billion. We have made some reductions. Most of them are consistent with the governor's recommendations. So we did reduce a bit, but that doesn't mean that we have less revenue that we are dealing with. I'm going to let Mr. Nauman go over the spreadsheets with you, and we'll talk about some of the policy efforts that some of these funding changes represent, and I'll be happy to respond to questions. Do you have a piece like that for me, too?
I believe it was in your pack.
Oh, I didn't grab my spreadsheets from my folder. We'll just get those in.
Mr. Nauman, do you want to go through the spreadsheet for us?
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Eric Nauman with Senate Counsel Research and Fiscal Analysis. Madam Chair, is it your pleasure that I go through the aid spreadsheet as a starting point for this discussion?
That would be helpful.
Okay, so Madam Chair and members, in the packets, I believe, is a document that's oriented landscape on a legal size paper that says appropriation tracking education budget fiscal 12-13. It'll help identify it from the levy tracking, which I believe is also in the packet if you have an interest in talking about that. The AIDS tracking has two vertical yellow bars and one vertical green bar. I think that's probably the easiest way to identify it. Yep, that's it. And so, members, I think in accordance with how the Finance Committee likes to look at this. That's the one.
This is the one. You're looking
that's for. The one. I'm gonna work off the leftmost yellow bar. This is the Senate bill as compared to the February forecast 12-13. The green bar makes a reference to the Senate bill 12-13 compared to February 10-11. The K-12 committee was very interested in looking at that comparison, and I'm happy to address questions to that. And Senator Olson made reference to that a few moments ago. So, Madam Chair and members, on working across the top, we have February forecast for 12 and 13, and then we have a truncated 14-15 calculation. If there's interest in talking about the governor's rec, those numbers are displayed smack in the middle of the page, and then the Senate numbers for 12-13, and then we get to that yellow bar that I made reference to. The largest portion of the education budget is the general education program, and that, in fact, is where a good portion of the changes are made in the bill. Members will note that on one of the very first lines up at the top is formula allowance. That's the basic formula allowance that accounts for the vast majority of the K-12 dollars. And the Senate recommendation includes a $50 increase each year for fiscal year 12 and 13. So there's two increments of $50 increase. So that raises the formula allowance from a forecasted 51.24 up to 51.74 and then 52.24. That's a 1% increase each year. And on line three, the dollars associated with that, $133.9 million above the forecast. The Senate bill includes a freeze on compensatory dollars at the FY11 level that recaptures some of the growth, and that saves $53.1 million. In many of the line items that we will see, and they are indicated with underlining, there are shifts. Senator Olson talked about the aid payment shift. In general education, we show that separately, and that generates almost $1.2 billion of savings, so that's a good portion of the savings in the bill. There's a slight increase of $8.9 million on the property tax recognition shift associated with the property tax savings. Then there's $13.6 million of savings on line 13 associated with a governor's recommendation to change the methodology on the property tax recognition shift. And line 18 is a governor's rec, as well as Senator Perry, I believe, had a bill to do a trial placement option at the Minnesota State Academies. That has a general education effect and saves $17,000. And Madam Chair and members, on lines 19, 20, and 21 are a Senator Hahn recommendation to capture savings associated with students that graduate early, out of the 12th grade or earlier, and allow those dollars to be used for an accredited higher education institution. So if a student graduates early, there's some amount of dollars that they can use to pay for higher education learning. And it creates a little bit of savings on lines 3.4 and 3.—savings on lines 19 and 20, 3.4 million, 3.9, and then a spend of 5.8. So on net, it does save dollars to the education budget. There are two initiatives from Senator Stumpf and Senator Carlson that made some adjustments to the sparsity calculations. Those are carried there. Senator Thompson had a repeal of the January 15th contract deadline that carries a $700,000 cost. And then the governor recommended and the committee accepted some changes to the LEP assessment, basically adding students that weren't previously tested for LEP, and that carries an $85,000 cost for that.
Madam Chair, that's limited
Senator
English
Olson.
Proficiency for those of you who aren't on the education committee.
Madam Chair, I apologize. And so the final line 29 in general education relates to the shift. So when school districts are in SOD, we leave them on the – we leave them – sorry, statutory operating debt. Catch me. I might do it again. So when those districts are in statutory operating debt, we leave them off the shifted schedule and leave them at the regular schedule, and that carries a slight cost of $4.6 million under the bill. So in total, the general education relative to the forecast is down $1.1 billion. And this is probably a good point to reference that subsequent lines I might glance over fairly quickly, even though there is savings. Lines 34 and 35 are good examples. Underlining means that it's a shifted program, so the savings there is just associated with the shift. And I'm going to concentrate on those lines that have italics. That indicates policy change. So that completes that page, and I'll move on to the subsequent pages. The next is line 62, the non-public pupil aid. There's a couple of things going on in there. Senator Olson had a recommendation to make some adjustments to some of the homeschool calculations and created a little bit of savings. I'll let Senator Olson speak in more detail about that. But in addition, the non-public pupil aid carries a slight increase. So we've got countervailing pressures associated with the formula allowance increase. Whenever this program is tied directly to the formula allowance, so when you increase the formula, you have to do an adjustment to this line item. And then Senator Thompson's salary freeze recommendation, which is contained in the bill, also contains savings in that line item, and those are booked. So in total, there's $3.8 million of savings in non-public pupil aid, but a good portion of that is shift. The other items that I mentioned are relatively minor. We also adjust line 63, the non-public pupil transportation, for the effect of the formula allowance increase. Madam Chair and members, on line 72, the charter school building lease aid accepted the governor's recommendation to make changes in eliminating the so-called grandfather charter school districts. Back in 2003, I believe, the overall formula for charter school building lease aid was adjusted downward from a 90% or $1,500 per pupil calculation to a 1,200 or 90%. And those those charter schools that were above the 1,200 that was created in 2003 were grandfathered in. This recommendation accepts the governor's provisions and eliminates the grandfather. So everyone will move down to a 90% or $1,200 calculation. On line 73, the charter school startup aid has begun being phased out. The committee talked about that to some degree because there's federal money that is also available for starting up charter schools. Madam Chair and members, integration/literacy aid is on line 76. This is the integration line item that has been on the committee for a number of years, and it is being phased out as part of the Senate recommendation. So school districts are locked in at their same aid and levy amount that they had in fiscal year 2011 for fiscal year 2012. And then in fiscal 2013, the levy goes away and the aid gets repurposed into another line item that I'll speak to in just a moment. There is a lagging payment of $19.2 million. That's residual associated with the payment shift as part of the K-12 finance provisions. So that subsequent line item that I mentioned is line 77. That's the literacy incentive aid. I'll let the chair speak to that. I'll just speak to the money. There's a total entitlement of about $85 million. We're seeing about $60 million of it here because in the first year of any program, you're only counting 70% under the current shift levels that we spoke about. Then on line 78, the reading instruction stipend program is a new initiative. There's $4.4 million for that. Line 79 zeroes out the magnet school and program grants. Those were previously $750,000 per year. On line 81, the inter-district DSEG transportation line item remains unaffected in fiscal 12 and is zeroed out in fiscal 13. And Madam Chair and members, again, line 82 is just shift, so you can move past that one unless there's a desire to talk about it. Tribal contract schools has policy in it. This one also is linked to the formula allowance, so when there's an increase there, we adjust that one as well. So there's a minor increase associated with that, but it's also shifted, so on net, it's a reduction. Line 93, early childhood literacy programs has been increased to 4.125. It was previously at 1.375. So that's a $5.5 million increase. The Minnesota Foundation for Student Organizations received basically a $75,000 increase each year, up to $800,000 per year. And Madam Chair and members, on line 98, the group called Education Excellence is down $27 million, and that largely reflects the shift reductions, although there is policy where I indicated. Madam Chair and members, line 101 begins a special education group in the bill. This is Article 3 of the bill. There's $263.8 million of reduction in regular special ed, and the next line item where there's major change is special ed excess cost, $21.9 million. I'll indicate that there's about $109 million of policy change associated with those items. The balance together is shift. Madam Chair and members, in the facilities area, the only policy change is on line 113. There is a fund transfer in the bill for Elk River. That school district still has a small enough tax base per pupil that it receives equalization aid. So members, when we do a fund transfer from a debt service account to a general operating account, we have to carry a levy effect for that. And because this district is equalized, we carry both aid and levy on this. In the tax side, you'll see all the school districts, because that's not the only school district that has a fund transfer. So there's also some districts that we're carrying a levy effect for, but no aid. Madam Chair and members, there is no change in the nutrition programs at all. There are no shifted programs. In the libraries area of the budget, there is a shift effect only. So there's no policy changes going on in that area of the budget. In the children and family support services section of the bill, there's $7.3 million of reduction, but in this case also there is no policy changes, just shift. The same would apply to prevention. When you get down to line 163, the adult basic education portion of the bill has a recommendation basically accepting the governor's rec to change from a 3% growth factor on the contact hours, which is the operative calculation in that formula that the governor recommended, down to a 2% calculation. And so that provision was accepted by the committee. Then, Madam Chair and members, moving on to the agency portion of the budget, that begins on line 177. There are a few changes that I will reference. In Senator Olson's language that has related to homeschool, there was a little bit of rulemaking, and we paid $10,000 in the agency budget for the costs associated with that. The alternative teacher now law that was passed by the House and Senate and signed by the governor earlier in the session has some rulemaking cost, and that's carried here in the Department of Education budget for $44,000. That's line 187. Then the early graduation achievement program, that was Senator Hand's bill that I made reference to when we discussed general education, on line 189 requires FTE, a professional education specialist, and that receives about a little over $100,000 a year, and that was paid for. And then on line 190 is an overall general operating budget reduction equal to 15% of the agency's existing budget. So in total, on line 192, the agency budget is reduced for the biennium $5.686 million. Moving on to the Purpich Center, the Purpich Center for Arts Education on line 197 was reduced $500,000 each year. That's about a 7% reduction. And members, on line 202, the Faribault Academies was reduced at the governor's recommended level, $309,000. And this is not a general operating reduction, but instead a reduction related to the fact that the Purpich Center would like to...
No, the Faribault Academies.
I'm sorry, thank you. The Faribault Academy would like to convert their food service or cafeteria service from employees to a subcontract for they would like to subcontract that. They believe that they have employees that are senior and are about to retire, and that it's a good time to do that and generate some savings at the same time. And the committee had testimony to that effect. And then, Madam Chair and members, on line 217 is the school aid payment shift savings associated with the tax credits. There are a collection of tax credits that get paid out on the same schedule as the aid payment schedule. There's $14.7 million of savings associated with that. In the fund balance, that line item was originally carried in the tax jurisdiction, but the Senate chose to carry that in the K-12 jurisdiction. We have done that both ways in years past, so it's kind of the Senate's pleasure which way we carry it. But as a result of that, we have to have an adjustment line to reconcile to our target. So on line 225, Madam Chair, you will see that the total spending for the K-12 bill is $14,158,034, which I believe is about $30,000 under the target, $30,000. The bill has been reduced, or the spending in education relative to the 12-13 biennium was reduced 1465561. And so, Madam Chair, the remaining lines are essentially summary lines that may be helpful for your information if you want to net out the effect of the shifts. Line 249 shows the total shifts in the bill. Because the Senate made some slightly different composition of choices, the original shift number when the targets were being calculated was 1.440. The Senate target, the Senate choices brought the shift numbers in at 1.444. And again, if you make that adjustment associated with the credits, you can see the total reductions to the bill are a net $21.2 million. But of course, Senator Olson's comparison from the very beginning indicates that there is improved spending relative to the prior biennium. So, Madam Chair, if there are questions, I'm happy to deal with those. If you'd like me to go through the tax levies, I can do that too.
Senator Olson.
Well, thank you. There are, as Mr. Nauman has said, some of the changes in the funding order have been a result of some policy changes. We had some additional revenue. Obviously, nobody's budget is flushed with all that everybody would like to have, but I think we also felt that it was of great concern. It was great concern that we do start down the road of trying to have some reforms that can help in the future in terms of the funding challenges. And that's one of the reasons that that we made some of the decisions that we did. We did capture the growth, not the growth in students in special ed, but the automatic growth factor and the growth in compensatory ed. We did not change the formula and distribution of compensatory ed or anything related to special ed. But those funds went to adding $50 on the formula. So while those factors will affect some school districts differently, there is a bit of equity there that I think many of our school districts have been asking for some time. It's not great, but it is a small amount by putting some more money on the formula. Aspects of our funding that has been under a great deal of criticism for a number of years has been the integration aid. And ever since the legislative auditor did a study and found that it really wasn't clear what its purpose was, and there was very little accountability to it, and it went out to approximately half of the districts, but at greatly differing levels. We had proposals to eliminate it altogether or to bring the amounts down to the average, which had a very detrimental effect on Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, which have designated amounts in statute. I didn't feel that I wanted to do that, but we did want to repurpose that aid. So for the first year of the biennium, it stays just as it is. And the second year, as Mr. Nauman said, it eliminates the levy, and the levy was in part used for several of the items that are in here, and I can elaborate on a little bit more of that. That we discussed in tax committee. If you wish to know what else that went for, we'll be happy to do that as well. But it's been transformed into a literacy incentive aid, because if there's anything that I think can do more to help us not only improve student achievement, close the achievement gap, it's to deal with the fact that we have rather abysmal levels of reading proficiency by the end of third grade. We've done some, you know, that we have done some work. Senator Saltzman and I worked very hard with a group that became known as the Moms on a Mission, and I think there's at least one of those leaders of Moms on a Mission here today, to help strengthen the preparation of teachers so that they have all of the tools to teach what is needed for struggling readers, not just ones that seem to automatically walk into or get enough exposure and learn in one particular way. And that's been at the core, I think, for much of the research that we've had learned of over the years and through the National Reading Panel, is right at the heart of the difficulty in of achieving proficiency. And that has great ramifications. It has ramifications for special education. Special education is costly. Rarely does anybody ever get out of it once they get into it. 5% is a common figure. And yet, from pretty credible sources, the fastest growing areas of special education, that of learning disabled and emotional behavioral, have very strong ties to being and often labeled instructional casualties. And that goes back to the reading issue. If kids can't read, often by the time they get to third grade, they are labeled and put into learning disabilities. And if they aren't getting the good reading skills there, they can continue on and will never overcome and be productive in their own educational growth that they need for the rest of their school career. It contributes to the dropout rate. It certainly contributes to the high cost of special education in our schools, and we have a struggle with that because we never get enough money for it from the federal government, who sets the requirements, and so we're constantly having to cross-subsidize it, and that's one of the challenges of the special education funding. So that is what we did with that is to create an incentive aid that will distribute the resources from that integration aid by a combination of proficiency at third grade on kind of a three-year rolling model, so that, you know, unusual blips don't greatly affect it, as well as growth. You know, we say we're not going to put all of our eggs in a basket of one test, but identification of proficiency, we have ways of determining that, and most of our school districts are using assessments that will identify growth rate, and that that is the way that the literacy incentive aid will proportionally be sent out to schools. We hope that it will be an incentive to work hard and to improve those growth rates, because it will bring more revenue. There's other things that need to be brought up, but I think this is one of the concerns in Minneapolis. Minneapolis has been starting to make some headway, and one of the things that they have done is that they have worked with the Reading Corps. It worked rather fast over the line about the literacy that says RTI and Reading Corps. We've made an investment in that. Again, was Senator Saltzman's lead, and I worked with her on that, to getting Reading Corps monies. These are people from through the AmeriCorps that are funded with federal funds. When we invest a dollar, I think there's at least three federal that match it, and there's also private funds that go to it. And they are trained to coach teachers and other volunteers to work with students, and they are working with students that are working toward that literacy goal. And there's a report that just recently came out, the March 11th report from the Department of Education on early literacy with Head Start, with early childhood literacy. I'd encourage you to read it. It talks not only about the effectiveness that they've had with the early childhood, but also in the K through 3 grades. And Minneapolis is one of the strong participants, but there's a map in that report that shows that they've been spreading all around the state. In this bill, we have tripled the funding for that, so that we can have even greater incentives. And for Minneapolis, also in that report, it indicates that the $500 million that the Target Corporation or the Target Foundation is investing in reading by third grade is going to a Minneapolis project that's centered around the Reading Corps and the five strands that we have stressed in terms of teacher preparation. So I would anticipate that by the end of this next year, there will be substantial progress, and I hope that Minneapolis can gain far more than their share by virtue of the growth and its achievement in literacy incentive aid. The incentive grants was also written in $1,000.
Senator Olson.
Excuse me.
We did have a few questions. Is this to the topic she's speaking about?
Well, to the literacy piece of it.
Okay.
Certainly. I get a couple more pieces to it. One is the literacy incentive aid. The other is the investment in the additional Reading Corps staff. And the third one, and that's for, you know, statewide. I think it'll go a long way. And the third one is $1,000 payment to teachers who are currently teaching, who go back and get they don't have to go to our regular teacher education places, but there are lots of good opportunities for developing skills in teaching reading to struggling readers. And if they pass the new reading test that's in place for beginning teachers, getting ready for their license in reading in elementary, they will get a $1,000 bonus. So those are the main things around the literacy provision that we hope will start to make a real difference, because I hope you can see that if kids are reading, they place less demand on some of the scarce resources. We have been putting a lot of money into compensatory and other categories of kids who tend to be struggling. We haven't been making much headway there. And I think sometimes, many of you have heard me say it before, it's kind of a subtle form of discrimination, of kind of sensing that, well, you know, they're in poverty and they can't learn. It's not true. It's not true. I was impressed with the St. Paul superintendent and the consultant that they are working with on a project that I think you can go in on a website. It was Dr. Reeves was here the day that they met with me just this last week, and he's involved with a 90-90-90 program that's 90% poverty, 90% minority, and 90% success. And they have proven that they can do it. And they have the methods and the means of bringing that to scale, and we want to see more and more of that, so that we have, I think it's going to contribute to a much more fulfilling lives for children if we can get them off to the right start, and if they can read, because that's the foundation of further learning, and will contribute greatly to their success through life. So that's my little spiel on literacy.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. Senator Olson, you kind of paused, and I thought we were on to something else. I apologize. Let me ask a couple of questions, and I'm far from the expert, as Mr. Nauman can tell you from numerous conversations. Mr. Nauman, I don't appreciate your laughing at that. You're just supposed to sit there and listen.
It's all right. He does good work, Senator Dodd.
Madam Chair. I know he does good work. Madam Chair, wait till Mr. Nauman says to you what he said to me once in committee. When I was trying to do some calculations, he said, well, I guess you're working it with your little pocket calculator there or something like that. And at any rate, I'm not the expert. But relative to the issue of literacy, and I appreciate what you're doing, what you're suggesting, but how does this comport with, because obviously the integration aid has been utilized by Minneapolis-St. Paul as a less onerous way, as I understand the history, to deal with the federal constitutional DSEG requirements. And I know there's also, I think if I'm not mistaken, there's a provision here that also deals generally with kind of the state standard or something. I've been glancing, trying to figure out where that language is, if in fact there is language of that sort. So how is this going to intersect with what has been a longstanding, not practice, a constitutional mandate, you know, going back to the 54 Brown v. Board decision relative to how we deal with desegregation in the public schools. And if we make this into kind of a one-size-fits-all, do we run into any possible constitutional challenges to what we're doing? Again, that's why I suggested, I'm not the expert on the intersection with the constitutional mandates with where we are in your bill or even where we've been, in the last several years. But
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, segregation is already prohibited by federal and state statutes, and as you indicated, the landmark Supreme Court case. We also had a case involving Minneapolis that was settled, and part of the activities that have been going on in this arena have been a part of that that settlement, which I believe has expired. I think we're at no... our state and many of our school districts, if not most, are experiencing an increase in diversity. I don't think having diversity in our schools is a problem. I think part of the reason, and if an underlying fundamental reason for desegregation from the standpoint, if it means changing the mix of people that are educated together, was the belief that they were somehow, there was substandard education going on in certain environments, and that if we were going to improve education, this was a step to doing that. I don't think that that alone has been successful, and that's why I think we're far better off of contributing to the upward mobility of people if they, in fact, get the fundamentals, get a good education, because that's their ticket. Educate. We all know that. We say it. We've listened to it on the floor. That is the ticket to self-reliance, to self-esteem, to improving your lot in life, to a good career. And so education is important, and it starts at the beginning. And we've been fighting with all of the dropout rate. We've been trying to deal with the fact that going to college, we had to have remedial because they were weak in reading and math. Well, I say let's start at the beginning. And we learned that if kids aren't learning proficiently by third grade, they're handicapped, and many of them never catch up. So there's more statistics that we could share in terms of the implications. You know, not everybody that can't read at third grade ends up in prison, but I think it's about 70% that are in prison that are illiterate. So it affects people's lives in different ways. And some of them can overcome and compensate, but for many it in itself is a handicapping condition, and it's one that can be corrected if we do it right. And so I think that is the kind of reform and change that we need to focus on and strengthen the ability of our teachers to address it and have a structure that will in fact reward that success in doing so.
And Madam Chair, if I can, I'm not going to belabor that at this point, like I said, not being the expert. Plus, I promised Senator Olson I wouldn't cause a lot of trouble for her today as I did for other chairman yesterday. But I would like to hear. I don't want to interrupt Senator Olson in going through her bill. I'd like to, when there's an appropriate time, maybe ask folks from Minneapolis-St. Paul to testify for a couple of minutes at whatever time you think appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I just don't understand one of the things you said. You said you were sure that the Minneapolis public schools would improve the literacy of their students and be able to compete for this pot of money that you're creating in the bill. But in fact, the reality of this bill is that it cuts $17.7 million out of funding for the Minneapolis public schools. And I know that's going to mean teacher layoffs, increased class size. I don't understand how, with that kind of a reduction, that the Minneapolis public schools are going to, in your estimation, improve the literacy skills of their students so that they will be in a good position to compete for this new money.
Senator Olson.
There are several runs demonstrating some different status on that. That the second year has a greater hit because of the change of the integration revenue. That is when the literacy incentive aid, though, also begins. And that's why I have spent some time explaining to you that this is an area that we have strengthened, not only put more money into the Reading Corps that is going to be, I think, is being used by Minneapolis and is going to be more extensively used. Those are resources that they will be benefiting from. And hopefully it's going to show in their performance that will access them more than what is even predicted right now for what they would receive in that literacy incentive aid.
Madam Chair. Senator Berglund?
I kind of get what you're saying. If we were holding things constant and this was money that was being added that Minneapolis might qualify for, but being that there is a cut the first year to Minneapolis and a much larger cut the second year, I can hardly believe that the new program that you're beginning is going to offset the damage that the loss of funding in the first place would do.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To find that.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes.
How much money was available per pupil in the integration aid, and how much money per pupil will there be available for this new literacy thing?
Madam Chair and members, perhaps I might be able to assist on that. It varies district to district on the integration, but I believe Minneapolis, I'm testing my memory here, I think was at 447 per adjusted marginal cost pupil unit. But if I'm getting that wrong, I'm sure someone will correct me. The way the literacy incentive aid works is that there's a total of $300 available, but that $300 gets weighted based on the percentage of performance at each site level. I apologize. So there are two components to it, as Senator Olson mentioned. It's first weighted by a site's performance on a growth measurement. So if the site is achieving growth at 50% level, then the formula will be discounted from 150 to 75 and multiplied times the pupils. And then there's a second component that keys off of the percent of students at the site that are achieving proficiency on the third grade reading exam. So those two together generate revenue at each site, and then that's pooled up to the district level. I think what Senator Olson was speaking to is that could act as an incentive, because a increase in the percentage of performance would generate more value on that formula allowance. But at the top, if you're getting 100% on both growth and on proficiency, the total amount that's available would be $300 multiplied times your students.
I hesitate to wade into this because I'm not sure I understand a word that anybody's saying. Is this based on the same number of pupils so that the net effect is there's just a boatload less money?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, it's based on the projections. We are getting additional revenue for additional students that were projected. The February forecast already, however, reduced that somewhat. The November forecast was forecasting a rather substantial growth in number of students. It didn't seem right, and it turned out it wasn't. And in the February forecast, that was reduced. But we still have been granted in the targets the growth of for covering additional students.
Senator Berglund?
If growth and student proficiency are the two factors that determine what school districts get this new pot of money, it would seem to me that school districts that have a lot of poverty are not going to be as likely to be growth districts, and it's going to be more difficult for them to have as many students that would meet the proficiency standard, because poverty has always been a barrier to student achievement. And so it seems like you're setting the formula up to fail for districts that have a lot of poverty and to succeed for districts that are wealthier in terms of their family populations.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, growth does not mean growth of students. It means that they have made growth in their progress toward proficiency, plus the percentage for those that actually have achieved proficiency. So there's greater potential. Poverty is a challenge, but it does not have to be a barrier. That's why I've said we have been putting so much effort in trying to assure that we try to overcome that sense of low expectations for children just because they're poor, that somehow it means they can't learn, because they can. As the 90-90-90 program is identified, and as the research has shown, these children can learn to read and learn at proficiency. And when they do, they will actually be able to be greater beneficiaries of our education system, as well as reduce the costs. If for every child that learns to proficiency at third grade that may well be assessed and end up in special ed and as a learning disabled, that increases our cost. For everyone that we would save, we are saving money for education that can reduce that cross-subsidy and allow greater investment in it. And I think we need to. We've been having a goal, and I certainly have a goal. We've got to get better results even with what we have now. And we're challenged by that, and that's essentially what we're trying to do in this environment.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chairman, just one more question, and that is, does the research also show that students are going to be more proficient in their literacy if their class sizes are becoming larger and larger? Because that's what's going to happen with the loss of this money for Minneapolis, St. Paul, Robbinsdale, Duluth, et cetera.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, there is a lot of research that says that class size doesn't have the impact that you might think. But when you do have challenges, that's one reason we're talking about the Reading Corps and some of the Teach for America, some of the various strategies that are used do focus on giving more individual attention. The RTI model that is the special education is moving toward, which stands for response to intervention or response to instruction, is a model that's instead of trying to base it on an intelligence model, it's more of a discrepancy model, and there's a constant assessment of how children particularly focus on the reading. And if they are making some progress, they may have a brief little assessment that the teacher administers every week or so. And if an intervention or an instructional method is working, they keep doing it. If it's not, they work on something else so that they can keep these students achieving and feeling success that they are, in fact, learning. And that's what we need to be doing. Because we can't continue on with absolutely flat scores while our costs are going up on an angle like this. If you remember when Peter Hutchinson was here and spoke about the what's happening in education, and we fit that model. Our NAEP scores for reading are flat as over the 15, 20 years, and the amount that we've been spending per pupil in real dollars has been climbing.
So is the Madam Chair and Senator Olson, is the idea here that somehow volunteers or other kinds of people working in various programs are going to replace the lost teachers in order to compensate for the fact that the students aren't going to get as much individual attention? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, no, it means that we're adding more support. There's potential for adding support, and we are at the same time trying to assure that our current staff, some districts have been doing more with it than others in terms of the professional development, of assuring that their teachers are getting the skills to work with struggling readers and than others are, and we're trying to bring some incentive to do that. And I share that goal is shared by our Commissioner Casilius and lots of entities around the state, whether it's the chamber, whether it's the different foundations that are committing to trying to get to the bottom and find the ways to equip our teachers and provide the support that's necessary to get across this hurdle of reading proficiency.
Senator Olson, you know, when you first brought this idea up to me, and I'm a former Education Committee member who, like Senator Bonoff said yesterday, was with the Transportation Committee kind of having a hard time letting go. And so I've missed being on the committee this year, and yet I think that I really like this proposal, because at first, if we were thinking of just proficiency, that would have been a major problem. And the schools like Prior Lake, which always does well on its reading tests, would have probably gotten all the money. And yet, when you put the growth factor in there, everybody has lots of potential for that. And the schools that have the biggest problems as far as where they are on their test scores have the best potential for growth. So they can actually capture quite a bit of this money through growth, and then when they become proficient, of course, they get extra money too. So I'm just impressed with the formula that you've come up with.
Well, thank you. I don't know if Susan Thompson is in the room, but if you wouldn't mind, she's one of the champions that's been working at all levels, and if you could attest to some of the gains that have been made. These are moms that the struggling readers are not confined to low-income folks. It crosses all spectrums. So it's an equalizer, but it's an equalizer that we believe should be overcome, and many of the parents that had the resources to find the kinds of help wondered why we weren't having this regularly in our schools and have been working to help change that and bring about some of these changes. She's
gone.
Okay, she's not here.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions for Senator Olson. I hear you say that, you know, poverty level doesn't have a big influence on reading ability, and I don't necessarily agree with that at all. But what I am concerned about is that I haven't heard you say anything about those districts that have a large number of immigrant children. And one of the five districts that I represent has 48 to 54 different languages spoken in at any one time. I know your school district doesn't have that issue. You might have a few languages, but certainly not that, and certainly not 80% free and reduced lunch. It's a small school district, and I used to be on the school board, and they've done amazing things with the limited amount of money they have, and they've had all-day kindergarten, and the community has been willing to step up to the plate to do these things, even though it's not a wealthy community whatsoever. But they've been really stretched to the end of what they can do. And as far as taxing, as far as class sizes, and, you know, the research that I've seen, especially in K through 3, it really does make a difference what the class sizes are, and particularly when you have children with very limited English language skills or their family doesn't have English language skills, and so they really aren't able to really help them with the reading. Our school district has done everything that it can do to get the parents literate in English as well and help them out, and they're doing a really good job with that. But these kind of cuts to districts like ours have a very much of a different impact than they have on districts like yours. And I really don't think that this, I understand what you're trying to do here with this rewards program. I just think that Senator Berglund has a point, that it's really difficult if the class sizes are going to be bigger. We've got the population, much larger population than most of you that put this bill together of children that have much bigger challenge in learning the language and learning to read in the language than the children, the majority of children in your district. It's really a test of patience and skill and ability of these teachers to make the progress that they've made with these kids. And they are making progress, but when their schools are cut like this and I see some of these other school districts in the wealthier areas that are maybe more able to raise their property taxes to cover their schools than some of the ones I represent, then I think this is, how can I say this without sounding, it appears discriminatory. It appears very discriminatory. And I guess I'd like an answer from you about how you think that schools that have a large number of children with the English language learning issue can make the same progress or anywhere near close to the same progress as the schools like yours in your district.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, I have 8 school districts in my Senate district, and they have there are some varying circumstances. Some of them are growing and are challenged with not so fluent revenues. They are shortchanged in many ways in the dollars they get for student as well. Some of them are more well-to-do, but years ago they were capped in their ability to raise revenue, and some of them have, you'd be surprised that they are not as flushed as you might think. There's diversity in all of them. It may not be of the same proportion, but they do have those same challenges. And to the greatest extent possible, if you believe, and I believe that's true with the immigrant children from all over, that they can learn, and they're anxious to learn. And I think that our schools have been doing a quite effective job in helping them to adjust as well as to learn the English language. And they need to focus on those methods that will get them communicating as quickly as possible so they can benefit from the education that we can provide.
Madam Chair, there is a point.
You know, there are the resources are different, I know. But, you know, Columbia Heights is that one of your districts?
Mm-hmm.
You're over $10,000 in the basic revenue, and that doesn't even include any of the federal funds or any of that. Now, most of my districts aren't close to $10,000. And Minneapolis is $12,668. Actually, if you add take their whole budget and divide it by the number of students, they have $20,000 per pupil. Now, that goes for a variety of things. But there is no district in my Senate district that has that kind of a budget that equals $20,000. And I think you'll find that some of the others around this table say that too. So it's what I'm trying to keep the focus on is the is the kids, and that to be sure that we are helping to equip our teachers, and that we, it isn't just the class size, it's what you do in that classroom. And the instructional, that I think there's more and more focus, whether it's the foundations, whether it's, you know, others are saying, what is it? What's keeping us from, when we know that there's research out there that some schools are successful that seem to have all the same circumstances and others are not. And there are elements that, that can be, if implemented, can be brought to scale, and we can, in fact, have 90% proficiency and success in schools that have as much as 90% poverty and 90% minority. I believe that, and I think if we abandon that kind of expectation, we're going to get the results of those low expectations.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
And Senator Olson, I assume that the Department of Education is going to be administering this performance program that you're proposing. And yet I see in your, and I'm sure there's several other new mandates on the Department of Education in your bill, and I see that you cut the Department of Education by 15%. In Senator Perry's bill, there's also a 15% cut to departments. So that alone, those two cuts alone, would amount to a 30% cut. How, you know, I just got to say that somehow or other, public employees and teachers are expected to get all so much piled on them that they can't possibly do, and yet we keep mandating more and more and more and asking them to take less and less and less. And I don't know how you can expect, it's really an insult to people to expect them to do as much as we expect them to do for the amount of money that we're willing to give. The Department of Education is being cut by 30%, yet we're mandating all kinds of new stuff. Teachers are getting freezes and have already taken freezes for the last several years, and they're getting most of their collective bargaining rights removed. And yet we're saying, come on, teachers, here, take bigger class sizes, and you got to do a lot more with what you've got. There's just a breaking point here. And, Madam Chair, I think we're reaching it real fast this session.
Madam Chair, and Senator Goodwin, this is not one cut on top of another. Education is within our bill. It's not within the State Department's bill. And so it aligns with the other departments. And I would add, too, that the calculation, as it has been worked on, and I think Dr. McQuaig and could probably describe that as well, it's all based on data that now exists, and it's a matter of electronic calculation. And so when you have current database, I don't know that it's going to add any great complication. One of the things in our bill, we specified that the cut wouldn't be borne by the finance division of the department, which does do a lot of that kind of calculation and distribution. So that is along with the Board of Teaching and the Board of Administrators are ones that are spared from the cut.
Well, Madam Chair, just one last point on that. 15% cut, I think it was yesterday or the day before, Senator Perry was asked if the 15% cuts in his bill were in addition to the cuts, the departmental cuts in other bills, and he said they were. So I don't know which side to go with here. So perhaps somebody can straighten that out.
Senator Perry, just to address that question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The 15 by 15, let us remember, is spread out across the entire state, and it gives the governor all the latitude and has provisions where there could be early retirements. So I think to emphasize that it's all in one department is wrong. And then follow up on the statement, I haven't yet heard Senator Olson talk about any mandates. Are there a lot of mandates in this bill, Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Olson. Senator Perry, no. In fact, we've been lifting some mandates.
So
will in fact but not only give some flexibility but ultimately save some money and particularly save jobs.
Okay. Senator Perry.
So, Madam Chair, I would just, caution us as we make our statements that if they're not going to be factual, it leads to that's what caught my attention when Senator Goodwin said that, you know, there are all these mandates on the schools, and I'm going, I haven't heard any of that. So I just wanted to clarify in this particular bill that there was.
Madam Chair,
can I just add a clarification too? The integration revenue involved having, for all of those other than the three, which I think just in 2009 we required that they submit a plan for how they would use that revenue, but the other districts have had to submit plans all along that has taken staff time to review, and that is being lifted.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Goodwin.
Senator Perry, I was talking about the mandates on the Department of Education that are in this bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen has been waiting a really long time. He had his hand up as Mr. Nauman was going through the spreadsheet, I think, and I thought, well, we'll let this presentation conclude. And so he's been waiting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions. A small town, Lancaster, here that was talked about in your spreadsheet. Can you explain to me the sparsity aid adjustment? Why there'd only be one town with that in Minnesota?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'd be pleased to try to unpack that one for you. It's been a longstanding challenge that the Senate committee has been attempting to address. What happened was that the Lancaster School District was affected by a decision made in a neighboring school district to close an elementary school and move the students to the high school. And in so doing, we effectively measure a district's sparseness relative to the next nearest elementary school. So by moving when the neighboring district chose to close the district that was further away from the Lancaster Elementary School and move the students to the high school, which was closer, it effectively turned off the sparsity aid for the Lancaster School District. This happened, I believe, a couple, maybe even 3 years ago. And the Senate committee at the time put some one-time money to hold them harmless. And the school district came back this year and said they'd like a permanent adjustment. And subsequent to that, we have dealt with this issue in other parts of northern Minnesota. And even Senator Carlson had a provision for the Northland School District that had a not similar effect, but also an effect where a school district was affected by some sparsity changes. And so the Senate committee took a sort of a holistic look and said these two districts should be held harmless for the effect of those decisions.
So follow-up, Madam Chair. So that doesn't happen that often then. So we're talking just some rare circumstances.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, no, it doesn't happen often, but in light of some of the declining revenues and some of the pressures on school districts, I think the committee wanted to ensure that school districts were not making – we're not using the sparsity formula as a reason for not making the right decision. Because I think you'd probably argue that the Kitson Central School District that made the decision, that they were making the right decision to, in effect, close that school, but it had a deleterious effect on a neighboring district. And we wanted those decisions to be made, but we needed to hold that district.
Thank you for that. Also, Madam Chair, if I might, the Purpich Center, in our notes here, can you tell me what the $1 million cut, what percentage that is? Maybe I can figure that out.
Madam Chair and members, it's actually $500,000 a year, so that doubles up to $1 million over the biennium. It's about 7%.
Senator Bonoff was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to have some things be more clear, because I think from the comments that we have lumped together what happened with the integration revenue from things that have happened to various school districts based on other formula changes, which would be, say, for example, the compensatory delinking or the growth factor for special ed. Because with regard to the integration revenue, what Senator Higgins and Senator Berglund were pointing to is a big difference in what they're able to get on a per pupil basis. So First of all, I think it's wonderful that we're putting our attention on literacy, and now school districts who are other than Minneapolis-St. Paul and Duluth and who qualified for integration revenue could get $129 per pupil for integration revenue. But in this new formula for integration revenue, they could qualify up to $300 per pupil with this formula. So, Senator, Senator Goodwin. So, Senator Goodwin, I was actually letting you know that your district actually could qualify for more based on this formula of integration revenue, almost twice what they could have gotten under the old integration formula. So the districts that are being hurt with integration revenue are Minneapolis-St. Paul and Duluth, who no matter how well they did, they'd still be, no matter what, getting cut. So I just, you know, in terms of if you're looking at some things that show your district doesn't come out well with this formula, that would be something entirely different. And the only thing we were talking about was integration revenue. So it just, I didn't want us to get ahead of ourselves.
And Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I believe there was a legislative auditor report on the integration aid and how it was used. Is that correct? Did they criticize how Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth used the integration aid or said we used it inappropriately or anything like that?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins. A couple of the things that that report said that was in 2005 said that the purpose of the revenue is not clear and that racial concentration actually increased in school districts, some school districts that participated. It was not clear, and the usage was, I think anything that the school districts wanted to do. In 2009, there was a change and a requirement that at least Minneapolis-St. Paul and Duluth had to submit annual budgets and their plans for that. But it was interesting that when we had bills before our committee to discuss or that were challenging the use of the integration revenue and trying to make more drastic changes. I tried to moderate this by not just cutting it off, but rather at least giving it a year of transition, and we see how this can adjust in. I'm not interested in trying to do major damage to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and if we can figure out something creative that will not do that, but yet not take away the incentive for some of the changes that may be needed, I'm open to it because I know that you face a lot of challenges.
Sure.
But the legislative auditor came to our committee meeting and he expressly said to me, "I'm glad that you aren't letting this die. It needs to be addressed," because they felt that it was not a wise use in terms of a statutory use and distribution of funds. And so we're trying to correct that and put it to repurpose it and put it to a purposeful end.
Thank you for that, Madam Chair and Senator Olson. Was there a bill introduced that eliminated the integration revenue or repealed the DSEG rule? Were there public hearings? What did the big three cities, actually they're the big three of the big four cities, I guess, because
Senator Higgins,
Rochester
I
didn't
think
get that whack.
Somebody is here, and we'll let them testify in a little bit.
But was there a public hearing before? Was there a bill?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, there was a bill that actually the bill that was the focal point of our hearing was one that took Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth down to the level, I think, of $125 that the rest of the districts. There's two levels based on the concentration of percentage of minority that brings in other districts. $92 and $125 or $129. and it was Senator Brown's bill. He didn't say what to do with the money, but he just cut Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth down to 129. And so that is the had hearing, we had testimony. I did not include that bill specifically. I think there's another bill that was introduced. I don't know if we specifically heard it, that essentially just eliminated integration revenue.
And it's, you know, Madam Chair, you get all kind of wound up in the committees that you work on, and I heard nothing about any of that going on. So I'm kind of just shocked that it's in here, because I guess I should follow education, but I'm on health care and environment and a few other things. And so I'm sorry to ask the questions. I just didn't know anything about it.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, education funding is so uncomplicated. I'm surprised that you haven't got it mastered with very little attention paid to it. But sorry, I jest. But it is a challenging arena, and it is not made easier by the fact that our school districts have so many different circumstances that face them. Mm-hmm. And I think our state has done very well. In fact, we have done, we're doing some work on it over the years as I've attended, you know, national conferences, and you've read anything, we've done very well by our core cities in terms of finance. Some of them have not gotten resources much different than the rest of the school districts in the state, in spite of the challenges they have. That has not been the case in Minnesota, and it isn't now.
Senator Olson, do we want to have Ms. McQuaid go through any other part of the bill?
Would you like to do cleanup here?
Madam Chair, Shelby McQuaid, Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis, and I would just add on to the conversation about the literacy revenue that it is data that the department has and it is collected because it is the state level exam on which those results are based. There is some data manipulation involved in getting a 3-year average out of those that data, but the data is all collected at the department level.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other provisions that I'm missing that the committee should hear? I shouldn't do that to you.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I don't know that there was, I mean, I can certainly address any questions. I can either go through the bill in part, or I can address any questions that the committee has.
Do members have questions? Senator Cohen?
Well, Madam Chair, and I know Senator Olson or Ms. McQuaid, whoever would like to respond. Because I'd asked the question earlier, and then I took a look at the reference in the bill, so I want to get back to where I was, because it sounds like we, rather than go back and forth on this integration aid issue. And certainly, Senator Olson, let me just offer the comment that I've talked, as you know, several times in this committee about some of the geographic inequities that have taken place and are taking place. And I appreciate what you've done to the extent that I think I have some disagreements, but certainly you've, I think, made more of an effort than and then some, arguably, than has been the case in other areas of the budget, you know, relative to Minneapolis-St. Paul. But I am concerned with the issue of DSEG, and I've looked when I asked a couple of questions earlier. I did not have the rules in front of me. Now I've got copies of the rules, and referencing the repealers on page 58. So, what does that do? And maybe Ms. Younger might help as well. What does that do in terms of again, federal case law relative to desegregation? Because I recognize in the bill that the repeal is for the purpose section, and I've got this in front of me, not the prohibition section, but I'm wondering in particular how that comports with, say, Brown versus the Richmond case. And whether or not we hold ourselves open to any possible litigation with what's been done in the bill, not so much on, you know, the de jure part of it, but the de facto part of it. So, anybody want to take a swing at that?
Would like to try that.
Mr. Chair, and or Madam Chair, and Senator Cohen, I speak English, but not legalese, but maybe Ms. McQuay can address part of it, and I will try as well.
Madam Chair, and Senator Cohen, I think I will defer to Ms. Younger on the case law aspects of
sorry.
The program.
You're very good. Yes, we have our attorney here. Good. Sorry.
But I would just add that the Choice is Yours program that was the result of some legal aspects that Minneapolis was involved in, that, as Senator Olson mentioned, expired in 2005. And so any laws that were premised on that lawsuit are not bound by that lawsuit. And maybe Ms. Younger can add to that.
And Madam Chair, a little bit. In listening to the response, let me be clear, I understand that. So I'm not, my reference isn't so much to previous litigation, but why don't we open ourselves up for any future litigation, because irrespective of what has been repealed or is no longer in effect, doesn't change the constitutional mandates that have been pretty clear, I believe, over the years from the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't think anything has contravened what those earlier decisions are over the stretch of whatever it is, 20 years or so from 54 to what, the early 70s? But I would defer to Ms. Younger to help me out with that.
Ms. Youngers?
Madam Chair and members, the repeal of the DSEG rule is not going against the constitutional mandates. We can't change the mandates that the state has. And, in fact, the state rule does have a policy against discrimination in education. There's the repealer is not touching those provisions. It's just the integration rule that districts that have plans and work with racially isolated districts. But the racial isolation came from parent choice. It didn't come from an intentional acts by the district or by the state.
Well, and Madam Chair, Ms. Younger, that's my question again. And my questions might fall into the category of, you know, a little bit of knowledge. You know, is a dangerous thing, because I understand that there's nothing to contravene the juror segregation. You know, the intentional discrimination, the intentional discrimination. I'm wondering more in the de facto sense whether or not the repeal runs up against some of that. So not the intentional discrimination, but in effect the unintentional discrimination.
So can I say something,
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, I suspect I haven't looked around here, but I bet there's somebody here from St. Paul. The plan that the superintendent has adopted, that essentially cut back on some of the magnet schools. Working back to getting to the neighborhood schools, hearing her acknowledge, we're a very diverse district. It isn't. There's what, 60 or 70 different nationalities. We've got diversity all around us. I think local districts can make some of those decisions that are in the best interest and in the interest of what the parents want, and so they can keep their focus on educating the children instead of disrupting their lives and moving them around if they don't feel that if they and their families and the local district don't feel it's in their best interest. And I believe the superintendent said, what was the amount of money they're saving in transportation alone is like $20 million. I don't mean to exaggerate, but somebody can correct me. I believe local districts, that the law still applies to them. I don't think we have to dictate the detail and force them to go through the plans and have state people either stacking them up in a corner or reading them and processing. I don't think that's necessary. I think we should trust our local districts that they are going to be serving the interest of their districts. And we do have inter-district cooperation in schools that there's movement back and forth. And I think the aid follows the students there. I visited yesterday with a group of Hmong students from the Hopkins district. The Wayzata was in they were in school. The others were on break, but the fact that they have had this opportunity and were doing very well, every one of them, at different grade levels, they were all planning on going on to college and probably the first in their families to do so. So these kinds of endeavors don't have to stop, but we don't have to dictate them either.
And Madam Chair, I know that you wanted to let Senator Olson get through the bill. We were dealing with the integration. That's why I thought maybe I'd jump back in, and that you'll have witnesses, folks who can testify once Senator Olson is finished, and I'll certainly defer to that. But just my other comment is that I think a concern, and again, falls in the category of, you know, a little bit of knowledge, is that in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, I believe we now have school districts that are majority-minority districts insofar as the enrollment is concerned. And so I don't know if that, and again, and the people from Minneapolis and St. Paul can correct me if I've misstated that, but if we're not at that point, we're certainly heading there very quickly, so that accentuates some of the need to make sure we're in constitutional compliance. Because it strikes me that that's what's happened in other urban school districts where you then have, you know, the suburbs brought into it and so on. So those are – but I'll wait till, again, Madam Chair, Senator Olson's had the chance to finish going through the bill. I just wanted to get back into that because, again, Senator Higgins was asking the questions relative to the same area, and then we'll have a chance, as you've indicated, I think, to be able to have a couple people testify.
Yes, and Senator Olson – I think there are some other areas that they're policy issues, but they have money attached to them, like the Early Graduation Achievement Scholarship Program that is probably brand new to most members, and maybe we'd like to go through that. And I don't know if there's a couple of others that we would like to pull out and talk about a little bit, just so members are informed.
Do you want just a general walk through the bill, or...
I think so. Just a general walkthrough.
Dr. McQuay is willing to do that, so
okay.
Why don't we have her quickly walk through? And
we don't have to have a lot of detail, but just a time to go through. I think everyone has their summary sheet, too, but it's hard to read it while we're having discussions, so it
I
might
think
be
the
good
chief
to go
author
through.
Of the early high school, Madam Chair, with college graduation with a college scholarship is sitting at the table, so I could add a piece on that point.
Madam Chair and members, Article 1, Section 1 just changes the calculation on the on how the definition of the interest and income for the purposes of the permanent school fund. Sections 2 and 3 are homeschool provisions relating to Senator Olson's homeschool bill that the Senate has seen in the past.
Madam Chair, that passed off from the floor with... all unanimous vote. So,
and Madam Chair and members, Senator or Section 4 is Senator Hand's, the beginning of Senator Hand's early graduation bill. And what this does is allow scholarships to go out to those students that finish up their high school credits early. And so the scholarship amounts are listed on page 5, beginning at line 10. And for those students who graduate one semester or two trimesters early, the amount is $2,500. For students that graduate two semesters or three or four trimesters early, the amount is $5,000. And for those that graduate three or more semesters or five or more trimesters early, the amount is $7,500. The allowable uses in Subdivision 3 are that they can be used at any accredited higher education institution that's in-state and out-of-state. And then Subdivision 4 sets up the application process, and Subdivision 5 is the enrollment verification. So the Department of Education has to receive the tuition verification from the higher education university. And then the amount of money from the general education is transferred for the purposes of that program.
Senator Olson, there was a small savings in that.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and members, currently what the fiscal note noted is that those students are currently taking post-secondary enrollment classes, and the amount of savings picked up by those students instead taking the scholarships of rather than taking the PSEO courses would result in some savings.
So if the students are working toward their high school diploma and going to college, they'd still be in the PSEO program. But if they actually want to get a diploma early and graduate, then they could access the scholarship fund. But they can't do both, obviously. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Sections 6, 7, and 8 of Article 1 are those more homeschool provisions. Section 9 of the bill allows, just changes the calculation of limited English proficiency. It triggers off of the test, and there's some students that the department was finding weren't taking the test, and so the department recommended picking up those kids for the purposes of LEP revenue. Section 10 is the language of the bill that actually changes the formula allowance, and Section 11 of the bill is the freeze on compensatory revenue. Section 12 and 13 are de-link sparsity from the formula allowance. Section 14 is the Lancaster and Northland County provisions relating to sparsity. Section 15 allows leased vehicles to be included in the total operating capital revenue. Section 16 is Senator Brown's, also the delinking of transportation sparsity. Section 17 and 18 continue the early graduation achievement program scholarships. Just brings it into the general education aid appropriation, so that includes in. So, since it is included in there as part of the open and standing appropriation, Section 19 was part of Senator Thompson's bill that gets rid of the set aside for certain aspects of the Safe Schools levy and maintenance of effort. Section 20 of the bill is a provision that.
Madam Chair and members, this was a Senator Bonhoff bill that adjusts the percentage of a school district's special education concentration, a charter school's special education concentration to be eligible to remain on the 90-10 payment schedule as opposed to going to the 70-30. What wasn't in Senator Bonhoff's bill but was picked up as a correction is lines 15-6 through 15.10. Inadvertently last year, House and Senate staff loaded into this provision originally an incorrect calculation. A chair's letter was written by both chairs last summer, Senator Stump and Representative Greiling, to say this is how it should be implemented, and we certainly wanted to make sure that we were reflecting that chair's letter so that language updates that.
Sections 23 and 24 are more homeschool provisions. Sections 25 and 26 are the session law language that just addresses that sparsity issue where other schools and other districts closed. And Section 27 is Senator Thompson's salary freeze language. And then Section 28 is a provision that was added in the tax committee. Just to ensure that any changes that other bills make, such as the tax bill, just are allowed to be adjusted by Commissioner of Education to remain at levels that are established in statute.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Just a quick question. On Section 27, the salary freeze, is this the legislation we heard in Senator Perry's committee authored by Senator Thompson? It's the same language.
Madam Chair, it's Senator Cohen. Was in Senator Thompson's bill, which has been passed, I think, your committee, but also on the floor.
Okay. And Madam Chair and members, the appropriation section, and then on page 23, section 30 is the repealer section. Paragraph A relates to the homeschool provisions, and paragraph B, those are the staff development revenue program. Reserve program, the staff development reserve, and the contract deadline repealer. And then, Madam Chair, Ms. Yunker will go over Article 2.
Ms. Yunker.
Madam Chair, members, then moving on to Article 2 of the bill, it starts on page 23. Several of the first sections deal with varying things related to teacher contracts and academic standards. For example, on 24, page 24, line 24, it adds career and technical education credit as far as when standards are being revised in science, and then as well as prohibiting the commissioner from adopting Common Core standards. Section 2, 3,
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's easier for me to just ask a couple of questions. So why are we getting rid of the core standards?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, this, Senator Cohen, this places a limitation on the commissioner adopting them as a part of the revision schedule. That happened this last year for language arts. It could happen in other areas, and we have, as a legislature, I think that's an action that deserves our attention, and the committee agreed, I think to a person, that it's a matter of when and how those issues are reviewed and where that decision is made.
Ms. Yonkers?
Then moving along then, section, 2 and 3, relate to making a passage of a basic skills exam a prerequisite for entering a board-approved teacher prep program. Then section 4 is a...
Madam Chair? I apologize for interrupting. But, Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify. I think I was perhaps the lone voice who was concerned with regard to the commissioner language and the Common Core standards because there is a... the Obama administration has put forward Common Core standards of, the Commissioner of Education and our Commissioner and the Governors and whatever are working on some Common Core standards that I'm interested in, and so I'm not certain about how this will all interact, but it is more controversial than at first blush. That's all I would say about it.
Well, Madam Chair, there was some controversy, I think, among some states. The states, through the National Governors Association, have been charged, or I think of their own initiative, worked toward developing these Common Core standards, and there's been a lot of work going into them. In the Race to the Top application, that was made a condition. And for those who don't always like to see the dictates from the federal government, which usually don't carry the resources to go with them, they were a little reluctant to have national standards come in by the back door. I think if the states develop these standards and the states choose to adopt them, I think that's their decision, and I think that's the spirit in which this was offered at the state level here in Minnesota for the legislature to take that action.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Yonkers?
Then, Madam Chair, members, on page 28, section 4 requires a teacher's salary increase to be based on student achievement, or at least 50% of it based on student performance. And then section 5 allows the school board to provide a qualified economic offer to the teachers. Section 6 does many things. Some it changes the... whether, depending on a teacher's dismissal or not, I think it allows for either a board hearing or arbitration, as well as changing the teacher contracts to 5-year renewable contracts. Section 7 is also part of the 5-year renewable contracts and giving the criteria that has to be looked at. Then again, Section 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, again, go along with that, whether it's a hearing before the school board or arbitration for a teacher's dismissal or discharge, termination or discharge. Then section 13 is a provision for the qualified economic offer for a school board, and this pertains to school districts in the cities of the first class. Section 14 is the 5-year renewable contracts for teachers in cities of the first class. as well as Section 15, and there was a Section 15 similar to that allows the superintendent to change the discontinuance depending on a teacher's ability or their license area and the district's need for instruction. Then Section 16 is the $1,000 teacher stipend for reading instruction of teachers who take that test. Then 17, 18, 17 and 18 pertain to full-service school zones.
And Madam Chair, that was a Senator Harrington's bill for that St. Paul needed to assure safe school areas and by adjusting some of those boundaries.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 16, Senator Olson, the stipend for $1,000 if they pass an assessment of reading instruction. Can you explain that to me?
Senator Olson. As the Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the bill that was passed a couple of years ago that tracked with the redoing of rules for licensure and teaching in elementary and particularly reading instruction was backed also in our legislation with a new assessment that assured that all of the aspects of the reading instruction were a part of their preparation, and so they are included in those tests, in the tests that be prior to licensure. Current teachers get some update and preparation in that teaching the reading skills as a part of their own professional development and take and pass that test, we are offering a stipend for that.
Senator Olson, does that include teachers who don't normally teach reading? It's for all teachers, even if it would be a FIED teacher in the high school?
I don't know if we've defined that. I think the aim was getting at the preparation up through third grade, although reading is becoming getting the attention from in all subject areas throughout the school career, partly because we've got a lot of students that have not achieved that proficiency, and so there are challenges that continue on. May need to be developed a little further in terms of detail and instruction as to where it goes. But the idea that those tests are predominantly at the K through 3 or 5 level that would be taken. So I think at this point that's the ones that would be taking that test.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the stipend is over and above the contract stuff. Then.
Yes, this has nothing to do with contract.
And Madam Chair, members, on page 43 is where I left off. It's section 19. It's section 19, 20, and 21 relate to college and the schools allowing 9th and 10th grade students to enroll in a college and schools course as long as the 11th and 12th grade students have applied for the course get first priority and that they need additional students in order to offer the course. And then section 22 is a charter school provision, which allows for additional single purpose authorizers, as well as giving current authorizers an extra year to apply and be approved by the commissioner. Then, section 23 is a charter school building lease aid provision, which is removing the grandfather for districts that received a higher amount of charter school building lease aid. Then 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, say 31, and 32 are relating to which was once Youth Works, and now it's going to be the Serve Minnesota Innovation Program. And this is also where the Minnesota Reading Corps program is under this organization. Then section 33 is the career and technical levy, which increases the levy. Then section 34 is the literacy incentive aid, and you can there gives the calculation where The subdivision 2 is that proficiency piece, and then subdivision 3 is the growth. Then 35 is related to the charter school startup aid, which is repealed. And then there's a literacy incentive aid limit in 36. And then section 37 is the literacy transition revenue, which relates to the districts that had received integration revenue. And then the appropriations. And then there are the repealers are in section 39, which is on page 58. And those relate to magnet school grants, the charter school startup money. Then there are some definitions that are no longer needed with the change of the youth works to serve Minnesota Innovation Program. And then some of the integration revenue or integration sections and authority for the integration rule or DSEG rule. And then paragraph F is the DSEG rule.
Madam Chair and members, Article 3 begins on page 59, and Section 1 removes the program growth factor for regular special education aid. Section 2 removes the growth factor for excess cost aid. And Section 3 is the appropriations. Article 4, Section 1 is some language assuring the bondholders that their debt service will be paid. Section 2 is a Senator Limmer bill that he brought to the committee regarding the health and safety revenue program. I don't believe there are any fiscal impacts to this. It mainly just changed the structure of the program and the way it's written and stuff. Section 3 changes the ballot language for capital projects. Allows the ballot to say, and this is language on page 68, that by voting yes, you're voting to renew an existing capital projects referendum that is scheduled to expire. Section 4 is language allowing certain districts that are members of the technology and information education system to levy for capital cost and finance improvements to a building. And then,
and Madam Chair, that is for the TIES organization. They have had levy for, there's a substantial number of school districts that use the TIES organization for all of their data and other kinds of efforts and conference facilities. And the building, they're in the Farmers Union building up at the, at the corner of, Larpenteur and Snelling, right by the State Fair. But it's an aging building, and so they've asked for a continuation of that levy authority for some significant maintenance projects with the building.
Seems to me they could use some more parking, too, from the times I've been there.
I think that's part of the agenda, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, Section 5 it allows the school district, Wayzata School District, to be eligible for the Alternative Facilities Revenue Program. They're scheduled to be eligible in about 4 years, and this allows them to enter the program a few years early. Section 6 is a continuation of that Senator Limmer bill regarding the Health and Safety Revenue Program. And then the following section is the appropriations. Article 5 begins on page 72, and a few sections here relate. The first section is the change in methodology for the property tax recognition. And then, as same with Section 2. And Section 3 is the change to the aid payment percentage from 73% in fiscal year 10 to 70% in fiscal year 11. And Mr. Nauman went through that on the spreadsheet. Section 4 allows districts to transfer $51 from its operating capital account to its undesignated balance in the general fund for an additional 2 years. Section 5 allow a few fund transfers, and Mr. Nauman mentioned one that's carried on the levy tracking spreadsheet, or on the aid tracking spreadsheet, that's Subdivision 3 Elk River. Section 6 is also the change in the property tax recognition, and then Section 7 is appropriations, and then Section 8 is the repealer, and this, Madam Chair, is the repealer of the allowing the cash flow for school districts. And Article 6 is libraries, and the only section there is appropriations. Article 7 is the early childhood education appropriations. Article 8, the prevention appropriations. And Article 9, the self-sufficiency and lifelong learning. There was a change here that Mr. Nauman went through on the spreadsheet, and this is to reduce the growth, the program growth in adult basic education from 3% down to 2%. And then there's some cleanup of some obsolete language there. The state agencies, Section 1, just was the provisions that Mr. Nauman mentioned, the savings for the trial placement at the academies, and then the appropriations to the department, the state academies, and the Purpich Center. Madam Chair, that the final article is the Article 11, the forecast adjustments, and that concludes the bill.
Madam Chair, I know that Mr. Gustafson would want me to mention that the forecast adjustments are carried in Article 11. And he was an EBO. He considered that to be the most important article of the K-12 bill. That's not what EBOs do.
Does anyone have questions? We don't need to go over all the policy language, but if it's tied to funding, Senator Magnus.
I'm sure I have an amendment if we want to do that.
We can take amendments now.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, could I ask one question on the sheet here before that?
If it's related to that, Senator Ingebertson.
Yeah. The school districts would have to come to the state of Minnesota, just a question, have to come to the state of Minnesota for their permanently transfer their dollars for operating capital accounts. Is that something that they've been doing? The second to the last page there. Fund transfers, it's called. Becker, Delano, Elk River. They have to come to the state to be able to do that?
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebertson, yes. there are, in these particular cases, there is, they particularly need it because their funds are left after debt service or bonding project has completed in general. And they levy for 105%, and sometimes that is not always needed, and there's some leftover money. That would ordinarily go back in property tax reduction.
Okay.
And in these cases, they have asked if they could move that over to the operating capital, which is for capital kinds of, it's the maintenance, the it can be the roofs, but it could be for computers and other capital kinds of investment, and we have done that for quite a number of school districts. We've been a little reluctant to move it just to the general fund, by at least keeping it into the capital area. I think that may be more consistent with what the voters may have approved.
Just a quick follow-up. Do any school districts decide to give it back to the taxpayer?
Mr. Nauman?
So. Madam Chair and Senator Ingebertson, frankly, it happens automatically in most cases. It is in those cases when a school district comes and says, we've got this accumulation of 5% over time, and we would like to repurpose those dollars and use it for something else, that and the legislature approves, that they get to do that. So the legislature has to be proactive in saying, in providing that authority.
Otherwise, it goes back.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Magnus, are you leaving? Okay.
Taking over the bill.
we can start with amendments. I don't know if anyone else.
This is different.
It's got to be out of order. That'd be permitted.
It's got to be out of order, Senator Cohen.
Well, Madam Chair, before we begin amendments, could we have a little bit of testimony from St. Paul, Minneapolis, and that may or may not affect amendments that we might offer? Would this be an appropriate time, or
before I guess we get into amendments? Could. Usually I was going to take comments on the bill after the amendments were made, but
Madam Chair, I think Senator Magnus had indicated he wanted to have an amendment.
Yeah, if he's ready, we could do his amendment, and then we'll. If I know we maybe don't have to hold our testifiers if they want to get going, we could take them after Senator Magnus's amendment. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had to talk to Chair Olson to make sure we were in agreement on this again. I have the A23 amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Magnus offers the A23 amendment. Would you like to explain it?
Well, Madam Chair, I have a unique situation, and I have a school that has a it's dealing with a library, and it's a city library, a school library combined together. And what has happened with this, under the current legislation, they must maintain the maintenance of effort requires them to maintain the same financial support they had in the previous year. And what's happened in this case, and this is a very unique situation because as far as I know, there are only two libraries like this in the state, one is in Pipestone, one's in Comfrey. It's a unique situation, but what's happened here is they had a longtime librarian retire recently, and of course they've been there many, many years, and so their pay was up there with some significant seniority. And when they left, they hired a new person, and so the pay is not nearly as much, and so they're penalized then by not maintaining the maintenance of effort. So what they're doing having to do is send money on or. Excuse me. Pay this new person the same pay as someone has been there had been there 30 some years. So, what I'm asking to do with this amendment is to remove that. In that specific case, a maintenance of effort requirement for the preceding year because of the extenuating circumstances in that school, city.
Does anyone have any questions about the E23 amendment, Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair. And Senator Magnus, so what about this amendment shows me that it's limited to just this situation?
Senator Magnus.
Well, because it's joint financing the library by the school district and the city, and there's only two of them in the state of Minnesota, one in Pipestone, one in Comfrey.
Okay.
If there's no further questions.
And Madam Chair, I accept this as a friendly amendment.
Okay. All in favor of the A23 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail, and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
And now we can take testifiers. Is it Mary Gilbert and Jim Grathwall from St. Paul in Minneapolis?
It's your turn.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Grathwall from Minneapolis Public Schools.
I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools.
I'll lead off, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank Senator Olson for all her work on the bill. I just want to alert you to the fact that I think eliminating integration revenue, eliminating the integration rule, are significant policy decisions. Under Minnesota state law, then there'd be no obligation on the part of any school to do anything proactive or positive to integrate their educational settings. There is case law on the federal level that I think you're making yourselves vulnerable, and I think that's a significant issue. I think the second policy issue is you're reallocating from high-need districts to low-need districts in the sense, but I'd assert first, everybody needs, all school districts in the state of Minnesota need additional revenue. We've frozen the formula for 3 years. We have a special ed cross-subsidy in the neighborhood of $550 million, projected for $600 million for the next year. When we cap the growth factors in the special ed formula, that cross-subsidy will grow. The formula increase that the senator provides in the bill will simply be consumed by that increase in your cross-subsidy. We can discuss the revenue per pupil disparities among districts in the state. I just want you to know that you get more revenue per pupil under our current law because of our current policy, which I think is a good policy, that where you have more need, you should apply additional resource. And to parse that a little bit, we know that a special ed student can cost $30,000 to $60,000 to $90,000 per pupil. It's federal law. It's what is right, and that's what we're happy to do. Same with ELL. You need to acquire a language, whether that's in one language or 90 languages in your district. It takes additional time to acquire that language. Time is money. And with respect to the compensatory kid or low-income students, it's a very strong research-based correlation between poverty and difficulty making academic achievement gains. And Senator Olson knows that in Minneapolis schools and in St. Paul Public Schools, we have superintendents and staff and teachers who believe in high expectations and in getting the job done and are committed to that in every way. And finally, with respect to the integration and DSEG part, in districts like ours where it's majority-minority, and you should know that there's 10 that are poised to be closer to that, Senator Goodwin knows that. There's many more districts that for core cities, for me to be able to effectively integrate, I need to have partnerships with the rest of, with my suburban partners. The WEMEP program relies on state magnet school transportation, which is eliminated in this bill. So it's Rod Serling-esque. You know, imagine, if you will, a district, majority-minority, no integration revenue, no obligation to integrate. The loss of integration revenue means I cannot transport students to my integration magnets. My ability to integrate through WEMAP is taken away through the loss of the state transportation grants. Right now we have 2,200 kids attending schools in suburban partners through that Choice Is Yours program. And recall that the Choice Is Yours program came into being because of a lawsuit, not against the city of Minneapolis or this district of Minneapolis. It was the 1995 NAACP lawsuit against the state of Minnesota on adequacy of education in Minneapolis. So one of the lead attorneys on that case is a colleague, formerly with the Attorney General, now a colleague of mine in Minneapolis Public Schools, and the linchpin of the state's defense was the state provides compensatory revenue, provides special education excess cost aid, provides integration aid. So the key, the three pillars or the legs of the stool in the state's defense on the NAACP lawsuit, which was settled in 2000, when Minneapolis came forward and said, we'll help. We'll open the doors and we'll have that open enrollment option out, which this bill takes away, the transportation for which this bill takes away. Anyway, I don't want to have lead you into a morass of integration policy discussion. And my only final note would be the approach taken in the bill on integration isn't supported in the Office of Legislative Auditor's report on integration revenue, which had little or nothing to say about the efforts in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth on integration other than you should get your budgets approved, which we corrected in 2009. So overall, I think we need a stronger, more muscular policy on integration, policy and revenue to support that. I want to say it's hard for elected officials to get their minds around that or put votes on a board in favor of integration. I think it's something that Jim Noble in that OLA report and Judy Randall in that OLA report were too politic to state, but the state has a gaping problem around race inequity. The headline in the paper the other day, I have it in my bag, I didn't bring props to the committee, a race gap on jobs and unemployment. We have race gaps on employment, healthcare. It's everywhere you look. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, and over to you, Mary.
Madam Chair.
One moment, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grethel, appreciate the testimony. Let me ask more directly in terms of federal case law and how it might impact. I want to make it clear, I was critical yesterday of Senator Hand's bill for utilizing what I believe was a hypothetical relative to a waiver that's not going to happen. So I don't want to fall into the same trap and suggest with this bill that Senator Olson's bill falls because of the hypothetical of federal action. because in the same way, it's a hypothetical. And I have no guarantee that a federal court is going to take action, and if they did, what that action might be. It's a little bit different from, I would argue, my criticism of Senator Hansbill, because there we have some very direct indications from the individual most responsible for the purported waiver of the president that would not happen. And I'm not trying to re-argue Senator Hansbill, but like I said, I want to draw the parallel that we're not quite sure what might happen in this instance. But having said that, I inquired a few minutes ago of whether or not the fact that Minneapolis and I believe St. Paul as well are now majority-minority districts, if that makes a difference in terms of what happens both internal to Minneapolis and external in terms of where federal case law might be. And second, I had offered this distinction of, you know, de jure versus de facto segregation. And I take it your testimony suggests that absent some of these less onerous provisions, that there might be some fear of that.
Mr. Graffel.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I don't have the benefit of a legal education, so I may, I don't have any expertise in that area. I was just trying to indicate that the state's defense in the NAACP adequacy lawsuit, it wasn't a segregation or it wasn't dealing with de facto de jure, it was dealing with adequacy of education in the Minneapolis public schools, rested on a defense that you wouldn't have under the provisions of this bill, or would be a weaker defense under the provisions of this bill. And when you look at all the moving parts together, it cripples the Minneapolis public schools' ability to integrate through partnerships with suburban districts under Choice Is Yours and WEMAP, currently how we're implementing, which is now a voluntary settlement agreement, part of our integration plan. Because your staff is corrected, it expired in 2005, but it's been a voluntary agreement on the part of the Minneapolis schools, WEMAP, to participate in a open enrollment with transportation. This bill pulls that transportation, eliminates the grant that funds that.
Could I just ask a question on that point? When you said that this was based on the adequacy of education in Minneapolis, and so it didn't really relate to money. Did it relate to outcomes, or I'm not sure how that ruling came down that it wasn't adequate, perhaps. The results, I'm assuming graduation rates, things like that, were not where they should be or where the expectation was. Was that part of that decision?
Madam Chair and members, the 1995 NAACP lawsuit about adequacy of education against the state about adequacy of education in Minneapolis did, you know, the plaintiffs alleged, you know, not good outcomes. The state's defense is we have done everything possible through applying additional resource to guarantee those outcomes.
So,
and I'm, Madam Chair, excuse me, I am sure I am oversimplifying.
But that's okay for me because I'm not an attorney either. But
legal minds in the room or studying this hundreds of years from now.
I was just wondering though, because Senator Olson is trying very hard with her proposal to improve education and education outcomes. And if the lawsuit was against the adequacy of education in Minneapolis, and we have a plan to try and improve the adequacy of education, I guess I'm struggling with why that would not meet muster, so to speak.
Madam Chair and members, I think the literacy aid is intriguing. I wish it had been filed as a bill and we'd had a public hearing and we could have had more knowledge and understanding. We've been focusing incredibly on early childhood literacy, and I've shared with the Education Committee, but would share with you, our data shows we're closing the gap in early childhood and up to grade one, matching growth on MCAs 3 through 8, 9, 10, 11, and increasing graduation rates. So you're seeing progress in the Minneapolis public schools in terms of all of the metrics we care about. Are we there yet? No. Would we like to go faster? Yes. I'm suggesting that removing $16.6 million from the equation, releasing us from an obligation or to provide integrated learning environments, even as you reallocate resources away from Minneapolis, even as you return some for early childhood literacy, that won't help us get there.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Grathwall, I assume there's a number of districts that are involved in WEMAP, correct?
Correct.
And this cut, I assume, will change the dynamics and the funding for the WEMAP program. And my school district is one of those. So this integration aid is definitely going to have an impact on my school district as well. Can you name some of the other school districts that are part of WEMAP? And can you explain what WEMAP is for people that don't know?
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, the West Metro Education Program is a partnership of, I think it's 13 school districts now, and from memory, the contiguous Richfield, Robbinsdale, Edina, Columbia Heights,
Hopkins,
Wayzata, Eden Prairie is in there, I think. Minnetonka is not in there. Who else?
anyone else?
St. Louis Park. Yeah, it's kind
Bloomington?
Of the first. Bloomington is not, I don't
first
think.
And second ring.
Brooklyn Center, St. Anthony.
Brooklyn Center, yeah.
Imagine the first and second ring contiguous suburbs.
And so, Madam Chair and Mr. Grathwall, this integration aid will be really taken out of the WEMAP program. So all of those districts, it will have an impact on. This is not just a hit on Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. It's a hit on a number of suburbs as well. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, yes. And it is the integration transportation grants from the state, which is separate from the integration revenue formula and the rule. Those are the three moving parts you're dealing with in this bill.
Thank
that
you.
Are eliminated.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, I don't sit on your committee, so this is the first time I've seen this integration aid reform issue. And I guess I'm just sitting here wondering whether or not you did vet this issue in your education committee prior to coming to the Finance Committee.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I did say that Senator Brown had a bill that essentially took the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth excess revenue. It was about beyond what the districts like Senator Goodwin's district and just brought them down to size. This $129 per pupil unit. And we had a whole committee session discussing that, not only with testimony, but an understanding of what the integration aid was and the concerns the legislative auditor had raised. I think we vetted the issue fairly directly.
Senator Newman.
Just follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Olson, during the vetting of that committee when it was being discussed, were there any attorneys knowledgeable in this area from the Attorney General's office or the Board of Education or school districts or the NCAA or were any knowledgeable attorneys that came to that committee and in effect waved you off because you were going this proposal is going to be in violation of constitutional guidelines or prior case law?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Newman. No, there weren't. I think people, the superintendents from Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth were there and testified. I think the topic came up of that former lawsuit. I was a part of a working group meeting with the folks during that time and trying to work toward a resolution, so I remember that very well. The one that is now essentially the clock has run out on that. But the issue is still, as the chair has brought up, is that they are looking for the adequacy in education. And I think that's something that we, from the very beginning of this year, I said we need to focus on the students and improving learning and trying to work toward that end. And it may mean We have to redirect some of our existing resources if where they're going isn't producing the result. Compensatory, this, we're talking about integration revenue here, but compensatory is a part of it. That is not, other than freezing the growth, that has not changed. Districts, virtually every district receives it, but in a very different amount. I think that ranges from $17 per student to $1,500 per student for compensatory revenue. And I think you could probably guess who gets $1,500 for compensatory revenue. So, and that's not changed. We're not changing that formula. If the freezing of the growth and using that revenue to add to the formula, which they are also getting the addition to the formula, is not going to change that and going forward.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Newman,
but just to make sure that I understand, there hasn't been any constitutional attorneys or education attorneys or attorneys presumably knowledgeable in this area of the law that have come forward and said, "Hey, Senator Olson, you best not do this. You're going to run afoul of the of prior case law, and it'll be an illegal piece of reform." Am I correct on that,
Madam Chair and Senator Newman?
Senator
not
Olson.
Yet.
That.
Maybe some attorneys on the floor of the Senate that will.
but in the thorough vetting of your committee, no one was there and warned you off. Am I correct on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, that you're correct.
Thank you.
Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to perhaps just Senator Newman's point, but Mr. Grawell also mentioned or asked if this provision was brought to the Education Committee, and I did have a bill that was similar in structure but dealing with the compensatory aid that did contemplate repurposing those funds to deal with proficiency in reading. And so I would just, my comment was that we did have a bill that was contemplating something similar. I think what Senator Olson has done is taken a little bit of a different approach, but similar idea of repurposing funding that is not very well directed right now, perhaps, or very clearly directed to something that could be measurable. So.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grethel, just a quick question and comment. Relative to the majority-minority district, how many kids are English as a second language that are part of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, in Minneapolis Public Schools, 25% of our students are enrollment are English language learners.
Okay, so I would assume that probably accentuates the difficulty as well. So, and then, Mr. Grethel, I feel compelled. I understand how you feel. I've heard this expressed to me several times during the session. I don't think there's any need at all for you to apologize for not being a lawyer. That's okay with me. You seemed very disturbed by that, so I just wanted to put you at ease. And
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I had the opportunity, but I let it pass me by.
Ms. Sullivan, did you have some comments you wanted to share with us?
Yes, Madam Chair, Mary Gilbert from the
Saint Gilbert,
Public
I'm
Schools.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's been a long week already, and it's only Tuesday.
Gilbert and Sullivan, you know.
Ma'am,
you have a song and dance number.
Yeah. just because so many of you are new to the issue, I just want to briefly, I actually worked, this will give away my age, on the original bill. My superintendent sent me over here when I started at the school district in 1987 to introduce a bill that actually provided integration revenue for St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth. And so I think there's been a question about why there are numbers that are different for the three first-class city schools. And that was in the year, you know, when I thought a levy was something that was next to the river because it was my first year at the school district. The reason that the numbers vary and where the actual amount came from is St. Paul had been cited under the old integration rule where you had to actually have a numerical quota in every building depending on the mix of white and kids of color within each building, and you couldn't exceed a certain threshold. We had been cited because we had tried pairing schools, changing attendance boundaries, a number of strategies, and we had applied and won a federal magnet school grant where we actually put in place the mainframe of our magnet school system that we still have in place. And at that year, our magnet school money was actually going away. And so for us to continue to offer a voluntary integration program in St. Paul, we did seek and did persuade the legislature, the governor, and the attorney general's office that we had a legitimate case for getting the money. And it was two parts. One provided the program money for the magnet school specialists and the additional costs in those schools. And the second piece was actually the transportation for those kids to leave their neighborhood attendance area and actually go to a magnet school. And so it used to be two different pots of money. And at one point down the line, that the money was converted from a levy amount or a straight grant amount to a per pupil basis, and then eventually they folded the transportation piece and the program piece all into one bucket. We still continue to use our magnet school money, our integration money, for the original purpose that we said we were going to use it for when we actually got the bill passed and had it approved by the legislature. Over that time, several other districts have qualified for the money, and because of the various nature of their districts, you know, it's hard to have a magnet school if you only have an elementary school and a secondary school in your district, and so other districts have had to do something different with it. We've always reported and gotten approval for our programs. We've always reported our budget. For years, we actually reported our budgets to the chairs of the finance committees instead of the commissioner. So there has been a lot of oversight about how we spend our money over the years. So I just want to get that out of the way. The other thing that I just want to clarify is under the strategic plan that we just recently, with a lot of pain and a lot of community input, adopted, relied on three things. One was that we deal with the achievement gap. The second was that we align our programs. And that the third was that we would have some kind of sustainable future with our funding, and that we're dealing with the same structural issues in St. Paul that you folks are dealing with here. As part of that, we took a look at our magnet school system and our community school system, and we said some of them aren't as magnetic as they should be. They're not attracting students, and they don't have the quality to be a technology magnet. They didn't have the components that would be necessary to draw students from out of their attendance area to that school. And the second is some of them were underperforming schools. And as a part of that strategic plan, we actually shut some down. We closed some last year, and we paired them with some successful schools. Senator Olson has been very kind in her committee. She's had several of those magnet school principals in to talk about the progress that they've made in St. Paul, the aerospace magnet, the MUN magnet, the Washington Technology magnet. Just to name a few, Dayton's Bluff principal was here as well. All of those schools are either have closed the achievement gap, are closing the achievement gap, or are outperforming the state in every one of the subgroups that you have. And so the problem we have with the bill is that we can't just dismantle our magnet school system. And part of the costs are programmatic costs, like our student placement center. For example, we get 4,000 new students a year in the last 3 years, about 4,000 students. 2,000 of those last year were ELL students. So when they enroll in the district, they come to our placement center, which is funded with our integration money. They get assessed for their language ability. They often need immunizations, or they can't attend school, or some other services that they get hooked up with. Then they get placed in the most appropriate program based on where they are with their language acquisition and some of the other needs that they have, disabilities or whatever. We offer language academy services at a few of our schools, not all of them, because we simply can't afford it. So to have the right services for the right kids, we have to create some economy of scales, and we can't have them in every school. As a result of that, we have to move kids to the building. So part of what we spend our integration money on is actually the transportation, which, again, was a part of the original appropriation and the need that we had when we got the original bill. The other thing is our kids are not living. Our housing patterns have completely changed over that same period. Our kids are not where our schools are and vice versa. So we have got to provide some choice within our system to make our physical plant work. We can't be redrawing attendance boundaries every year. And we also have to move kids to some of the school sites where there, you know, there are seats available because the birth rate in some of those precincts and some of those neighborhoods have actually dropped. So that's really our dilemma. We can't just quit doing something because the rule went away. We still have these inherent costs, and they still are going to continue. In addition to that, our integration funding funds, our Native American Indian Language and Culture Program, K-12, for that population, it provides money, bilingual teachers, all-day kindergarten in our some of our racially isolated schools that actually have some of those language academies. You add that to freezing compensatory, and we really do appreciate the fact that Senator Olson and the members didn't change the formula. The problem is that it's frozen at the fiscal 11 amount, and we've seen what's happened with the proration for special education. And so the fact of the matter is if it's frozen at a set amount, it's not, you know, going to continue to – it's probably going to be prorated even the second year out of the block. And as to having the money all go to the literacy aid geared at having all kids read by the age of three, I just brought an example.
No, third grade.
I mean, that's what I meant. Levy, third grade three. For example, Harding High School has 2,100 kids. 1,464 kids in that building are native, are not English speakers. They're not. They all have to pass the grad. The writing, the math, you know, the grad. We've had a tremendous amount of success at that school. We have, and Senator Olson would be so proud of this school, we have 8 secondary reading teachers at that school. The whole curriculum and the money we use, integration, compensatory, special ed, is geared at closing the achievement gap at that school. The African-American kids between 2006 and 2010 went from 39% proficiency in reading to 62%. We doubled the gains in special ed. I mean, every subgroup had huge gains. We wish that our kids just came to us as pre-kindergartners and stayed with us the whole time. The problem is that that's not how they arrive at our door, and that's not the age that they come. And so our issue is that we are trying to teach reading at every single grade in St. Paul, and so we just can't take all of that and refocus it, and especially when we have a $349 per pupil cut to begin with. Something's got to be cut. And so it's going to be some of our intervention programs. Our class sizes are going to be bigger. We do a lot of when Catherine Rich was here from the Hmong Magnet School, we have 4 sections of academy classes that are about 25 to 1 kid with a ELL teacher and a paraprofessional who generally speaks the language of the kids. And, again, those are the resources that we use with integration, compensatory, and special ed to make those programs work. But they also have to get there. So it's the combination of the funding sources that have actually contributed to the success that we've had that Senator Olson's committee, you know, has had some of the principals come and talk about. And so I think that if they weren't taking the money from St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Duluth to fund this new literacy program, there would be far less objection. In fact, I think we would be, you know, right there cheering her on. And I appreciate the fact that there's an urgency, and the same urgency I think was expressed by my superintendent. So what she did say was she doesn't want to bus kids around for the sake of busing kids around. And because we do have a high... you know, we have our demographics have changed. However, we do the strategic plan that we recently adopted relies on regional magnets and citywide magnets, and the alignment. For example, we have 3 Montessori elementary schools. Part of the plan included a Montessori middle school. Again, there's going to only be one in the city, and so the kids who choose that as an option are going to have to get there, and so. It's just hard for us to imagine that we can continue to have a plan. And we have a lot of community investment in that plan from all of our community. I mean, they came out in full force over the discussion. about the strategic plan. And the fact that we just limited some of the choice, we have already been sued by the NAACP as a result of just adopting this strategic plan. So completely trying to dismantle our magnet school system as we have it today would be, I think, viewed probably much more seriously by them. So anyway, I'm happy to answer any questions I can or provide
Senator Perry.
With additional information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Ms. Sullivan, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, is it Gilbert or but Ms. Sullivan, thank you. I'm trying to
it's
get
Ms.
a hand.
Gilbert.
It's Gilbert?
Gilbert is all that I see.
It's Ms. Gilbert. Okay.
Finally caught it.
Senator, I thought you were teasing me.
No, I was just. Okay. I was listening intently on what you were saying, and I just want to clarify something. So you were part of this organization, I think you said back in 1985, correct?
87.
Or 87. Did I hear you right that this integration aid at that time was for transportation? Is that what you said?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. It was a combination. When you have a magnet school, generally you have magnet specialists or you have some kind of a thematic theme of some sort or another where you have additional teachers or resources. For example, an immersion school, you'll have bilingual teachers at the program. If you have a creative arts magnet, there'll be an additional focus on music or orchestra or theater. And so part of the revenue was for the additional cost of the teachers for the magnet school focus, and then the other portion of it was for the transportation, because as you all know, it's cheaper to transport a student in a small attendance area, which is why non-public transportation, charter school transportation, transportation for open enrollment is more expensive, because you don't gain the same efficiencies because you're picking up kids from a broader area and taking them to a school rather than just having a small geographical region.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I was, that was a, I think I probably didn't make myself as clear as I wanted to. What I'm trying to get at is when this program started, it was started to integrate students by bringing them into the schools. That's what I understood you to have said.
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, part of it, yes, part of it was to bring majority students into neighborhoods that were higher minority students and vice versa.
Okay.
Senator Perry.
And this would be what, thank you, Madam Chair. So along with that, the original intent was to bring students in at the same time pay for the teachers, because that was the other part of this. So that was all. See, what I'm trying to get at is, because originally I thought you said that it was started in 87 to bring students in. And then a little ways down, you said then it kind of, you didn't use the word morph into, but you made the statement that it was, and then we started needing, you know, teachers in that. So what I guess I was getting at is on the original formula for this, the intent of this, it was dual, is what you're really saying. So if we went back and looked in 1987, we would see that there was a dual purpose. It wasn't just for transportation.
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, that's correct.
Thank you.
There were two different distinct formulas. Yeah.
Okay. Now, Senator Cohen, Were you going to offer an amendment?
Madam Chair, I have requested amendments be prepared relative to these issues. My thought is I will not offer the amendments, and the reason being, although I share the concerns and expressed, you know, by both Ms. Gilbert and Mr. Grethel, I mean, obviously, I wanted to have some exposition of the issues from the affected cities. I recognize that the amendments become, I think, as drafted, probably difficult to offer because the amendments as freestanding amendments, I think, become a tough fit for Senator Olson's bill with what she's doing. And I also recognize, to be honest, the votes aren't there to pass the amendment in this committee. Listening to the discussion, both from Senator Olson, our staff, as well as the representatives for the two school districts, I'm a little bit uneasy about the direction we're going. I think Senator Olson proceeds in good faith. I understand Senator Newman's questions relative to, nobody has testified to say absolutely you're going to be found out of compliance and wait till you see what happens. I don't think any lawyer with any intelligence would offer that kind of testimony or advice. But I have some fears, given some of the changes in the school districts in the state. I mean, if we go back to the 80s, if we go back to the 70s, these school districts were much different districts. St. Paul, Minneapolis, to a lesser extent Duluth, have become areas a little bit more similar in makeup and demographics to other urban areas in the country. It's caught up to us. And so I think to change a program that was more of a, I'll suggest, a low-key desegregation program, as indicated, where it wasn't as dogmatic as might have been necessary in other urban school districts, and was meant to provide desegregation support without, like I said, as much of a dramatic legislative effort. I think to change that to a literacy program, which, as Ms. Gilbert indicated, is something that sounds like it has great promise, but to do it in that way, I think raises concerns for those of us from St. Paul, Minneapolis. I hope this works. Obviously, I hope we don't find that St. Paul, Minneapolis have become that much more disconnected from the rest of the state. And if that does happen, it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen in 6 months. But if that does happen, the suburban areas of the Twin Cities will regret it, because it'll have the inevitability of slipping over the city lines. But at this point, I might have another amendment, but not relative to this.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get a few things clear. With regard to the magnet schools, there's no reason why those schools would have to close, because they would still get their per pupil amount. There's no reason that removing the integration aid and then it's now being substituted, to this other literacy incentive, which does create a shortfall between the literacy incentive and what you were getting. But in terms of closing magnet schools, Ms. Gilbert, why are you saying that you would have to close magnet schools?
Ms. Gilbert?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, we use a large portion of our integration revenue to actually transport the students to the magnet schools. So it's a combination of program at our Student Placement Center, our Native American Indian program, resources for the schools, for the magnet schools and some of the racially isolated schools, as well as transportation. The literacy money is required to be spent only on services to improve reading through third grade.
No, it's not.
Senator Bond? No,
well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Ms. Gilbert. This doesn't say how you have to use it. It rewards you for what you've done.
Yeah.
That was the point. It was being distributed to encourage that focus and the achievement and reward that. It's not totally dissimilar to, I think, what the governor's, one of his proposals, doing it by a different mechanism, is in a concern about improving literacy. But I don't believe it says. Is it?
Right here.
No,
Okay, it is to do that. You can do that in magnet schools, though, too, can't you?
Ms. Gilbert?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, again, the language says it can only be used to increase the number of third graders meeting or exceeding proficiency. So I would say that it would be, yes, to the extent that integration aid was spent for all day K in some of the schools, obviously that would be a legitimate expenditure. There's two issues. One is there's a $359 million reduction in total aid, and it is limited specifically for the use to elementary schools, whereas we use our integration revenue in all of our schools at all of our grades. And in addition, as I said earlier, because we have a magnet system in place, we would still have to come up with the money somewhere else to provide the transportation, which means we'd have to cut something else that we're doing in the district to do the transportation. So the problem is you can only spend each dollar one time. So if we spend it on this, then we have to cut something else, to do the transportation.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would agree. I don't think that was my understanding of the intent, and so perhaps we'll work on that. I hear an amendment coming. But but also, Mr. Chair and Ms. Gilbert, there is a line item when we go through the tracking sheet that we cut our transportation as, you know, the integration transportation area. One thought I had was would, and I don't know if this is possible, but would that be something, do you know how much you're actually talking about, and would that be something you could levy for if you had, you know, some discretionary levy for the transportation piece?
Ms. Gilbert?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, I believe that we spend our total transportation budget, I think, exceeds like $24 million for all the categories, and I believe we have about $9 million or more in our integration budget. So DSIC transportation.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Gilbert, it's about $9 million that you spend with your integration-related transportation.
Right, and we don't have all of our DSIC transportation in that budget. Okay. We currently spend more on integration activities than we get from the state. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason that we addressed some of those issues in the strategic plan was because of that we were already spending more than we got under current law.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chair and members, I just looking at the spreadsheet that we have that shows the effect of the changes. My understanding is that the spreadsheet shows the effect of the changes as compared to the forecast. I am aware that there was another spreadsheet that was produced showing the same data but compared to the current spending level. And if the members would like to see that, it might be helpful because it may change some of the numbers that appear negative on this sheet are negative with respect to the forecast but are positive with respect to current levels of spending. And it just may be helpful for members to see that.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Roebling?
I am off of the subject, but I do have an amendment. And I don't know. If there's no amendments being offered on this, I think we
didn't
probably
see any more
have
discussion.
To move on.
Was there more discussion on this? Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A22 amendment.
Senator Roebling offers the A22. Would you like to describe that for us, Senator?
Well, in the previous years, we have had the ability to borrow money from the school districts if we needed to use it for cash flow purposes. And I understand we had a threshold that only those districts that had reserve balances would be able to would contribute to that. And it has been a tool that has been used by the state when needed or if needed that helped them through times when there weren't sufficient funds in the cash flow account. And Senator Olson has in her bill a repealer of that, and I have some concerns about that, and so I wanted to address it because we know that we have a deficit and the cash flow account is going to be very low, and we have a need perhaps. We're not sure, but it could happen that we might need this tool in the future. So Senator Olson and I have had discussions about this, and my amendment actually puts the language back in, but it allows for interest payment to the school districts if we have to use the money. So those districts that have accumulated some reserve funds would not be penalized for doing that, because we don't want to discourage that type of behavior, and it would allow us to pay them back at the average daily invested treasurer's cash interest rate. Now, it's hard to figure out exactly how much we might need for that, but we are estimating $200,000 to $300,000 a year. So we asked Mr. Nauman, and I will ask you to explain this, because just recently we discovered that there was a little additional money available because of a change in the February forecast, I believe it was, that we were not aware of. So, Mr. Nauman, could you explain where that money is coming from?
Senator Olson, did
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, before you get into that, I promised her that I was going to whine a bit about this. and so I want to, I just a little historical perspective. It was in the 80s that this provision was put in place that actually required the state to take from those fund balances that were in excess of $350. It had never been used before this last year. And I think when it was discovered and it was close to a need, and I think it was used this last year for the first time, the law, either or within the last biennium anyway, it does require that whenever it is borrowed from that or removed from the payments to the schools based on those fund balances, that it must be repaid by May 30th of that year. There was several of us had bills in to repeal that. We ended the last session with the compromise of making it permissive but not requiring, because the state was required to do it. Governor Pawlenty had also, when they did have to exercise it, used his own discretion of elevating that fund balance level to $700, anything in excess of $700 rather than $350, to accommodate some of the inflationary impact of that number from back in 1987. The amendment this year it's a concern talking to superintendents that share with you the fact that the fund balance is not cash in the bank. I mean, the fund balance statement is not always the ready cash, and at a particular point in time, and some of them feel a little bit upset that they in turn then have to go and borrow money in order to help out the state when they have been responsible and the state hasn't, essentially. And so that is why we have some sympathy for school districts that have been able to accumulate some fund balance and then ultimately have have it taken away from them and are forced, in order to meet their cash flow needs, to have to borrow money and pay interest. So Senator Roebling, I'll quit the explanation that constitutes my whining, and indicate that she has sought out a way, since I raised the issue, that at the very least you could pay interest, and that might in fact cover the costs to the school district. And we have to recognize that the cash flow condition and the condition of the finances in the state does have an influence and an impact on our local school districts and their ability to, in terms of achieve interest rates and so on. So she has made an effort and used our fiscal guru here to find a way to see if we can accommodate that challenge of it at least paying interest for the time that that money is borrowed from the school district. So then now I'll give it up to Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Nauman, she keeps trying to demote you.
didn't quite make
Mr.
it.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think it might be helpful for me to ask you to pull out the spreadsheet that we worked off of before as we try to unpack how we're going to pay for this in this amendment if it goes on. And I'll, with a preface saying that my task was to, in effect, find $300,000 a year based on some analysis that Mr. Gustafson did with in cooperation with the Department of Management and Budget. And subsequent to the movement of Senate File 1030 out of the Education Committee, we had the chance to go back and unpack some of the governor's calculations inside general education and discovered that when the governor did the shift after repricing his budget, the so-called SOD calculation for holding school districts harmless on the shift if they're in statutory operating debt. Senator Higgins is not here, but she would say, what is SOD? It's statutory operating debt. And instead of carrying the $4.6 million cost that we did in the Senate bill, the governor's bill, or recommendation rather, carried only $4 million. So it was a bit of a happenstance that what we needed was $300,000 a year, and there was $600,000 of potential savings if we just accepted the governor's recommendation on the SOD calculation. So what will happen if this amendment goes on in line 29, if you look under the governor's reprice for fiscal 2012, we will show a negative 605 in the same manner that the governor's calculations do. That will carry a $4 million cost as opposed to a $4.6 million cost, generating the $600,000 of savings, and will allow us to carry a subsequent line of $300,000 each year with a tail to pay for the interest costs.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
And members, have you got that now? Good.
Senator Bono.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Roebling, I'm strongly opposed to this. Last year, Senator Olson and I were the two people who both put in bills to repeal this section of law. And I have felt strongly that it's irresponsible for us as a state to manage our cash such that we are leaning on our school districts in this way. I think it puts a great burden on them in their own financial management. And as I understand it, that in this committee, in the tax committee, where was the transfer where funds went from the cash flow account to something else that took our cash flow account down to
the tax committee.
In the tax committee, down to $50 million. And that didn't seem like a very smart thing to do to me. And I actually teased Senator Michelle about it because he says you gotta have the money in your checkbook before you write the checks. Well, yeah, that's right. And so I think we are not to plan for continuing to have that behavior rather than do the work of getting ourselves in a in structural balance and make sure that we aren't going to be borrowing from schools. So I'm disappointed. I was so pleased that repealer was in the bill. I thought, oh, all right, we made it. And then, I'm disappointed. And so I do oppose this. I'm wondering, should it be optional for the school districts? Perhaps a school district is in such a situation where they'd like the interest and they're willing to be the bank. But shouldn't that be up to a school district?
Senator Roebling?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it still says that the governor may authorize the holding of these funds so that they wouldn't get paid until May.
Right.
And so I don't know. Perhaps there would be flexibility within that. But the problem we had when this appeared in the bill, management and budget was very concerned about it because they know that we need tools. And it isn't the structural balance. It's just the cash flow. And cash flows into the state at various times there's a lot of it, and then at other times there's not much of it, and so it's just to help if we need to even out the stream of cash. It doesn't mean that we'll be operating in deficit or anything. It just helps us even that out. And we could, you know, we've gotten a line of credit, and we could go out and do it that way too. But apparently the bond houses particularly favor this method. And we are always concerned about our bond rating, and we want to make sure that we have tools in place if the need arises in order to meet the cash flow. And so that's why I'm asking for us to leave this in and then leave the appropriations set there if it's needed. Like Senator Olson said, it was only used once. And if revenues continue to come in, as they have been in recent months, well above projections, all that money goes first into the cash flow account. And so that gets replenished first before the budget reserves or anything like that. So, you know, we're hopeful that we'll continue to see that happen as it has in recent months. But this is just a backup, and it gives assurances to the bond houses that we have a backup.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the way the law is written, they have to pay it back by that May 31st. When we did this before and we were looking at the cash flow projections, it looked like, and I think things have changed, but it looked like there wouldn't have been cash to pay it back. What happens if the due date comes and we aren't in the black? What would happen?
Senator Roebling?
I imagine maybe since we wouldn't be in session, maybe we would have to go get our short-term loan from somewhere else. I'm not sure if that, but, you know, if the statute says we have to pay it back, maybe that's what we'd have to do. I'm not sure. I don't know if anyone else knows, Mr. Gustafson or Mr.
Madam Chair, I'll just offer one thought. It says that it has to be paid by that date. It doesn't say that it has to be paid on that date. So I trust that the Department of Management and Budget would manage its cash in such a manner that it had the resources. But in the event, as Senator Bonhoff poses the question, that if they did not have the cash, then this is designed to reduce the need for short-term borrowing. But if they didn't have it, they would have to go out and do some short-term borrowing, I trust.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I think I support the amendment for the reason Senator Bonhoff opposes the amendment. And that is that this provision remains in statute. I agree with Senator Bonhoff, this is not a good way to handle things. But since it's there, if we allow the interest to be paid, it offers at least a little bit of a small safety net to the districts. But what concerns me is a couple of things. First of all, Senator Roebling, the discussion is that we need to do this because we're going to end up with a cash flow account of only $50 million, which kind of reminds me of the old joke of the fellow who murders his parents, then goes to court, pleads for sympathy because he's an orphan. We're the ones doing it. We're the ones taking the cash flow account down to $50 million. And so, Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, you've got some control over that. So if that's a problem, don't do it. Second, what disappoints me about this is the borrowing also took place from the colleges where they had reserve funds. And it's a concern I have generally, and it was related to Senator Fischbach's bill this afternoon, that, you know, we bend over backwards for the K-12 system and with every good reason, but we at the same time will give short shrift to the higher ed system. And that created some real displacement for the colleges as well, not just simply the school districts.
I think it must be something higher.
Third, I raised the question at some point, I forget if it was the fall, but it must have been the fall, when in the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy, and I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, what your intent is, the majority's intent is to do with that commission. I certainly would be delighted if you decide to utilize that commission and you don't have it meet forever and ever and ever, as was the case. But in one of the meetings, when Commissioner Hansen talked about the need to borrow, and this was going to be the second go-around, the first go-around, there were some significant reserves. The second go-around, for both the school districts and the higher education institutions, the reserves are going to be taken down to a relatively low level. And I raised the question that I never thought I ever would raise, which is whether or not it was more fair for the state at that point to look for short-term borrowing as opposed to going to the reserves, since the districts and the colleges were being forced to be the place where we got the money in the absence of proper fiscal planning by the state. So these other entities, through no fault of their own other than the statutory authorization, were being compelled to serve as the short-term borrowing solution for the state, as opposed to the state doing it by itself. So, like I said, there's some concerns I have with what's in statute, in the same way Senator Bono phrases those concerns, but because the statute's going to be there, this at least provides something small, you know, relative to where we are. And having offered the criticism of both right now and yesterday as to where we are with the cash flow account, even if you kept the cash flow account at the 350, you still arguably run into some of the same problems depending on to what extent there's a deficit. And for that reason, would support the amendment.
Senator Roblin?
Yes, thank you. And thank you, Senator Cohen. I know you had this available as a tool previously, and I think, you know, at first I thought, why not just go out and do short-term borrowing then? But apparently it is looked upon more favorably by our creditors or potential creditors to have this available in-house before we would go out. And so I would love to not have to do this, but even if, as Senator Cohen said, we had a lot of money, our cash flow does fluctuate quite a bit. And by April 15th, when people pay up, we usually have a lot. So May 30th, we're usually flush with cash about that time, and that's why that date is set, I'm sure, in the law, the current law. And so anyway, I just would renew
Senator
my motion.
Cohen?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I would defer to Mr. Gustafson, having come not directly from MMB, but having been there previously, relative to the bond houses. But something what I learned over the years was that there's no question the bond houses look for all sorts of things that can be utilized by a state before the state turns to short-term borrowing and looks for all these internal stopgap measures, whether it be a budget reserve, a state budget reserve, cash flow account, or something like this. And so I recognize that. I recognize that to some extent we are not necessarily at the mercy of the bond houses, but certainly take into significant consideration how the bond houses look at these kinds of other stopgap and safety valve measures we have. Having said that, this is the one that, in effect, takes our problem and forces it on other entities in a way that I think in the second go-around became quite onerous.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Roebling, candidly, I'm very happy to see that you have come forward with this amendment. I will support it, so don't apologize. This money that we're talking about, it's not free to our local districts. And just on a sheer equity question, it seems to me that if we're going to borrow money from them, we ought to be paying for it. And so I will support this amendment because, at least in some small degree, it's going to protect my local school districts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, it also does protect them if our credit rating is good. And so there is an added benefit there for the districts as well, that they benefit from our good credit rating.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman and Senator Cohen, in Senator Olson's current version of the bill, Senator Olson had repealed their ability to borrow at all. So adding the interest, yes, is better than not doing anything, but it still is a change from protecting them entirely. And last year when we first did borrow from the schools, we were actually put on a watch list from the bond agencies at the time. They did look at it without favor, and I spoke to a few different bond counsel at the time and got varying opinions. So I'm not going to dispute what the MMB says, and I trust that you've done your research, and so I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just saying that it still doesn't look good for the state of Minnesota to have to be doing short-term borrowing from their school districts. It is noted by the financial community.
Okay. If there are no other questions or comments, then Senator Roebling has moved the A22 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have the bill as amended before Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to offer a quick amendment, the A21 amendment, more to present the issue to the committee. And as it's being distributed, I'll explain. Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think you were involved with this issue several years ago in concurrence with Senator Pogemiller, and that's the 18-year-old, the compulsory attendance to 18 years of age. And this has increasingly bothered me. At this hour, I'm not sure I expect the amendment to pass. And obviously, Senator Olson, I think probably in opposition to the discussion, you'll suggest there's also a fiscal issue that's not considered in this amendment. But when you look at where we're going in terms of the census data, society, whatever, and just the absolute imperative need for more education, not less education, I think if the effort, and Senator Olson, I don't know when this was done originally, but as I remember the discussion, I think the issue was, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the feeling that, look, if you're just going to be this obstreperous student at the age of 17 and you're going to cause nothing but trouble in a classroom, you don't want to be there, we don't want you there. You're going to have an impact on the other students and to their detriment. And I think maybe I'm paraphrasing that in a much more simplistic way than was the case when this was passed. But clearly, everything you read, everything you see suggests that we need to keep kids in the education system, and that the student, the former student who doesn't get the high school degree is that much further behind in terms of socioeconomic status. We can talk about what happens with the achievement gap between white and minority communities. Clearly, kids who are not getting education, getting a high school education completed of whatever race, are that much further behind. Students who don't go on to post-secondary are that much further behind. That is clearly the direction we're going in. And so I think for the state to make continue the policy of not forcing students to complete high school, I think exacerbates any number of other things outside the sphere of high school, just compounding the problems we have. So it's something that's kind of bothered me, and I thought, well, this would be a pretty good opportunity at 8 o'clock this evening to offer this issue, and so would move the amendment.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, I think I probably know who prompted you to do that.
Nobody.
Nobody? Oh, okay. That's two of you now that have this on your agenda. I don't remember what year it was that this was passed, and it was had a delayed implementation date, and I may have been the one to carry the bill. If not, I was a strong supporter of its repeal, and we actually repealed it. I think the word you used is that's the key, is we should force them to do it. I think if you listened at all to what I said earlier in terms of literacy, I think that lack of those foundational skills getting into high school is one of the reasons kids drop out. The lack of options for learning in different ways, which is the reason for our trying to bolster up and not lose any more of our career and tech programs, because there's kids that can learn better in an applied way and often have proven, there's evidence that they actually perform better on the tests of academic subjects than if they had been sitting in an academic class. There's where our focus should be, to keeping kids in school and not forcing them there to be there against their wishes, where if they're not necessarily going to learn, it's going to cost us more, it's going to disrupt others. And I see Mr. Aronson there. If you want me to call on him to put in his perspective on it, as from the high school principal's standpoint, I'd be happy to do that. We have debated this for several years, and I think the decision has come down, no matter who has controlled the legislature, that forcing kids to do it isn't going to be the answer to improving our graduation rate. And I think that hopefully some of the initiatives, if we can keep them going, that will improve that learning and keep kids excited about learning, are going to be a better resolution to this than mandating this attendance aid. Yep.
And Senator Olson, I know we've had a lot of discussion about this over the years, and it usually came with a fiscal note.
There is a fiscal impact, Madam Chair.
And I think it might be it's to the schools and maybe even to public safety, because there would be some efforts to keep these kids in school, you know, because they'd all be considered truant up to age 18 if they weren't showing up for classes. And so I know that I don't know how much money is involved, and I don't know if Senator Cohen has found out or not.
Madam Chair, the primary, I don't have the command of the exact number off the top of my head. My recollection is it was a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, and it was primarily driven by increased pupil counts. Because if these were students that would disenroll earlier, and then the department makes an assumption about higher pupil counts.
Would you like to testify?
Mr. Aronson is the
Aronson.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and the Secondary Principals Association. As was the case in the committee, the chair actually made a compelling case not to adopt this amendment before I said anything. And I would repeat the same arguments that she's made. We do oppose this amendment. We opposed it when Senator Wieger offered it as well, for a host of reasons and the ability to effectively manage our schools. Senator Cohen isn't wrong in terms of the overall goals, but the overriding policy as identified by Senator Olson makes a lot more sense to us as school principals. There's another cost buried in here as well, not just the one identified by Mr. Nauman, but when you raise the habitual truancy level to age 18 from 16, you incur a significant amount of prosecutorial pieces on this as well for local prosecutors. And I know that in the past we talked about that, and that was mentioned in the policy committee as well. But notwithstanding that piece of it, this would not be a good bill for us, or a good amendment at all for the management of our schools, and we do strongly resist this. And we appreciate Senator Olson's efforts in helping us, Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to indicate that I think that Senator Cohen is right, but I think Senator Olson is more right. I would also say that under Section 19, this would absolutely have to go in front of the Public Safety Committee, so I would oppose the amendment.
Madam Chair, I've moved the amendment. I'll take Senator Newman's comment as a half victory.
So you would like us to vote on it?
Sure.
Okay.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Senator Magnus.
Just a question under the habitual truancy language in Subdivision 19. My question is, what is a lawful excuse? Is that in the statute? I mean, what does that mean?
Does anyone want to take a shot at it? Mr. Harris?
Mr. Chair, Senator Magnus, we actually do have a list of identifiable lawful excuse. It's in the education code. Districts are authorized to adopt a
a policy that allows students to be gone for illness, other matters that are excused by the school principal. And so if they're not excused absences, then it clicks right into the criminal code with the number of days that they're gone. I'd have to look again. It's class periods at the high school level on a certain number that qualifies into the habitual truancy statute. So, but they are identified in the education code. The primary one is illness, but other things that are excused by the principal and by local policy.
Madam Chair, I know most of us don't really have any involvement in agriculture anymore. Certainly like we used to when Grandpa grew up on the farm or whatever we're at stage now we're at in life. But, it was pretty prevalent in years ago that, you didn't hire all your help. You raised most of it. it was pretty common practice that you spent several days out of school. In fact, I did. And, my dad went to the eighth grade, so he wouldn't have. He'd have been in trouble under this. But, it reminds me of a story. I was talking to a young guy, or an old-timer out in South Dakota one time, and they had let him out, the kids out, to do some wheat thrashing out in the fields, and they let him out for almost a two-week period, basically almost shut the schools down. And the trouble was he went back to school the next day, and he got in a fight, and he got expelled for a week, and... So his dad said, Gordy, what in the world are you doing home again? He just went back to school one day, and he said, Dad, they gave me a test. I'm so far ahead of the rest of the kids, this teacher sent me home for a week. So I didn't want to make – I wanted to make sure I knew what lawful –
That's street smart.
Madam Chair. Senator Cohen. It wasn't my intent to get into a long debate, but I just – Senator Magnus kind of makes my point to the extent that in past decades, there's been lots of folks who've been successful absent a high school education, absent a college education. And I just think that's significantly less true today.
So Senator Cohen moves the A21 amendment. All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Nay. The amendment does not prevail. So is there any other discussion or amendments on the bill?
If not, I would.
Senator Olson, I just wanted to make sure there's no one else in the audience who had been waiting. No one else has signed up, but if there's someone else, I'm going to give them an opportunity. If not, you may make your motion.
I would move that Senate File 1030 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the floor.
Senator Olson's motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay.
No.
Oh.
The motion does prevail. The amendment is recommended.
The bill
is passed to the floor.
The bill is.
Oh, pardon?
What?
I forgot to say. The bill is. I'm sorry. I forgot to say the bill was
amended.
As amended. The bill is amended is recommended to pass to the floor. So I don't think there's any other business. We are not going to meet tomorrow. We're going to have a very lengthy floor session, and so the Finance Committee will not be meeting, maybe not until next week. So you put in your time.
Madam
You've
Chair.
Done a good job, Senator Bonner.
Do you know what, because I haven't seen the floor agenda yet for tomorrow. Do you know what's on the floor tomorrow?
Yeah, Health and Human Services and
state government.
Health
big
and
government.
Services. And
yeah, so I have a speech.
I'm sure you do, Senator Cohen.
If there be no other business, the committee is adjourned.